Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org. And Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing compassionate care and cancer specialists who are experienced in the cancer you have. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, late Friday night, House Democrats passed President Biden's $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, committing huge financial resources to repair the nation's roads, bridges, broadband, among other things. But in his latest column for the Washington Post, columnist E.J. Dionne says Biden and his party still have a way to go in securing faith among middle American voters, many of whom swung red this past election day. He'll explain. Then we'll ask you what, if anything, moves you in your political decision-making these days.
At noon, we'll be joined by Boston Mayor Kim Janey, here to reflect on her tenure, which the Boston Globe's Janae Osterhout called short but historic. She'll also talk about how you prepare for the transition to mayor-elect Michelle Wu. That and more to come. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there. You know, and by the way, you got to talk a little faster today because, you know, the sun goes down at like 1 o'clock. So I'm trying to get out of here before the this is just horrible. In any case, the Democrats have finally passed, as you know, President Biden's infrastructure bill, dedicating more than $1 trillion to rebuilding the nation's roads and bridges and more. As Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne writes, though, it was a protracted and chaotic process that only further damaged Democrats' standing as well as Biden's, at least for now. E.J. is joining us online to discuss the successes, more broadband access, clean drinking water, cleaner energy, and the ugly process that Democrats went through to get it and what the implications of that might be in elections coming up. EJ is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist at the Washington Post. His latest book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. Good morning, EJ Dionne.
Great to be with you.
And you.
Well, EJ, I hate to tell you, the progressives and the moderates do not seem to be uniting.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. This morning on my playlist, the Byrds version of an old Bob Dylan song, My Back Pages, came
out. Oh, yes.
Great song. And the line that just jumped out at me for our conversation was mutiny from stern to bow. And I was thinking, and from port to starboard, you know,
that's
the
right.
Party.
That's
is
right.
Sort of really enjoys kind of making their ship a mess, and they did it. Some of the members on the day they finally passed that bill used language utterly inappropriate for this program to describe what a mess they seemed to be making of things. And it was only when actually the Congressional Black Caucus stepped in and said, "Wait a minute, this is really bad," and they proposed the deal that finally got the bill through, which is to say, you know, the progressives will vote for the physical infrastructure bill. The moderates will pass the rule to get the other bill through, the one that progressives really want. And five of the moderates who were holdouts signed a statement saying, you know, if the numbers check out, we'll vote for this. But it took all day long and, as we know, months and months to get to this point. And boy, was a lot of damage done to the party in this period.
Well, the argument, one of the arguments for the so-called shellacking in the elections just a few days back was this kind of chaos and division. The Democrats can't get their act together and that maybe they'll be more look more organized and efficient to the voters if they finally do pass some of these bills. But do you buy that? Is that what's going on here? Is it something else that's going on? What do you think?
You know, I realize that I should be more humble, and we all should be more humble in drawing lessons from a piece by a political scientist called Seth Maskett, who's written a book about how people draw lessons from politics. Everybody looks at an election defeat and says, "This defeat proves I was right all along," whatever the "I was right all along" means. And progressives say, the party's too left-wing. And the moderates say the party's too left-wing. And the progressives say we haven't done enough to deliver for our people. And when these kind of fights happen, I think it goes back to that old commercial, you're both right, you know, that each side has a point here. I truly believe that this, and have all along, so I can be suspected for my view, that this fight really did hurt them in those elections, because it made the party look ineffectual and it made Biden look weak, that he couldn't deliver what he promised to deliver. And so that was a problem, I think, that afflicts all sides of the party. I think the progressives are right that when you looked at these election results, the Republicans were far more successful in turning out their base than the Democrats were. And I think that reflects a sort of a general unhappiness among Democrats about what's been delivered. It is, by the way, and here I am repeating what I would have said anyway, the Democrats really have to pass bills to protect voting rights, because if they walk away from that, their base will really be debilitated. But on the moderate side, I think the Democrats really have to do a better job making a case that the stuff they're for is not exotic, it's not radical, it's not socialism, it's just basic stuff to make people's lives a little easier, like childcare, like pre-K for everybody, like healthcare for everybody. None of these notions are radical or socialism. And so I think the progressives and moderates have to sit down in a room and say, if we don't sell this thing together, we're going to be defeated separately. And if I can, I guess that's a paraphrase of Ben Franklin, right. But I think they've got to figure out how to do that.
Well, you know, you were just laying out, AJD, on some of the things in this, I hate the expression, Build Back Better, but that's what it's called. The infrastructure bill, I was reading this morning about what's in there. All of us complain about crumbling infrastructure, and all of this addresses that sort of thing. But my fear coming out of this, I mean, a lot of people, Democrats reacting to the horrible polls from last week, very low approval rating for Biden, said, well, that was before the great economic news on Friday. That was before the infrastructure bill passed. I continue, and I know I'm not alone in this, so it's not an original thought. Every single congressional race, in my estimation, is going to feature Terry McAuliffe saying, I don't think parents should be telling schools what to teach. This is the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. He speaks for all Democrats. Representative so-and-so agrees with him, whether he or she agrees with him or not. I think these culture war things, once again, the Republicans have totally outsmarted the Democrats, and I think that's what next year is going to be about. Am I wrong?
At the risk of exaggeration, I think that Terry McAuliffe line was the worst debate line, the most damaging debate line since, some people out there will remember this,
Gerald Ford
insisted that Poland was not under communist domination in 1976. He didn't mean to say that, but the words suggested that. And no, this is a disaster because every parent wants to have some say in what happens in the schools. They worry about their kids. And what McAuliffe was trying to say was sensible, which is you shouldn't let right-wing extremists who sort of crowd school board meetings threaten school board members. You shouldn't let them set the curricula for the schools. That doesn't mean the parents don't want to say. So I totally agree with you that that was an incredibly destructive destructive moment. Democrats really need to be much clearer, and progressives too, more generally, about what they're saying about race in the schools. They don't want indoctrination. They just want all Americans to be fully aware, and kids especially, of the role of racism in our history and the fact that racism is a real problem in our society. You can say that, I think, without scaring off anyone except the people who'd never vote for you anyway, who don't want the word racism mentioned in the schools at all.
So, EJDM, my theory is that the country is so divided on its news sources that one group is living in one wonderland, and the other group is living in another wonderland, and ne'er the twain shall meet. So I'm wondering, with this infrastructure bill, because I'm not sure lots of people know that the child care tax credits that were so successful in lifting children, I'm not sure that people know.
Child tax credits.
Yes, where they came from, that they were part of this new administration. And I'm afraid that these bills have been so shrunken in terms of money that the impact of them is not going to be very widely felt. I mean, if you only give help to childcare for people that make under 60 grand a year, that's going to leave an awful lot of people out getting any help with childcare. And that's what President Joe Manchin, as we call him these days, wants.
Well, I think that the biggest problem, the child tax credit was passed as part of the original bill.
Right.
They passed without much difficulty at the beginning of the year with help from President Manchin. They have not done anything serious to sell that, to tell people, hey, wait a minute, this money that's coming into your bank account, we voted for that. We created this program. And here's what I think let me play my optimistic role here that I am playing less these days than I used to. It is true that the economic news was good, and the COVID news is starting to get good. This little pill, if it's as effective as it seems, could also help us get to the point where we can actually say this thing is behind us. But the economic news on Friday was, staggeringly good. The Democrats, if they get their jobs done this year, pass the second bill, pass some kind of voting rights bill, they can move into next year and spend a lot of their time, number one, dealing with the underlying problems that people are worried about. Everybody's favorite words these days, supply chains and dealing with inflation. They can make these bills work. We progressives never spend enough time, I think, on execution and how important that is. But they have a whole year to tell people things are getting better. Here's what we did to make your lives better. And so they got a shot at doing that. And they have a lesson from Obamacare, which is they never explained it. They never told people what was in it. It took effect after the terrible elections for the Democrats in 2010. Maybe even Democrats can learn when they're hit by a 2x4. It's a long shot, I know, but maybe it can happen.
We're speaking to EJ Dionne. We're going to talk about voting rights and the filibuster in a second. One more thing, it just occurred to me. I hadn't thought about this till this minute when I was about to say EJ Dionne from The Washington Post. I'm sure you read your colleague, I don't know if you did, Marjorie, Dana Milbank's piece about the a victor and a loser in New Jersey and in Virginia. And what I was unaware of until I read his piece, I'm embarrassed to say, is the margin for Murphy in Jersey was almost exactly the same as the margin for Youngkin in Virginia. And Milbank makes the point that in Virginia, what's his name? McAuliffe issued a statement or made a statement, I don't know, congratulating Youngkin and his family and wishing him luck in the election. And again, same margin. Is it Ciccatelli? Is that how you say his name? Whatever his name is. Ciccatelli, whatever the guy's name is.
Well, now you've got me confused.
Okay, forget it. Whoever lost, the Republican who lost by the exact same margin that McAuliffe did, unlike being full of grace like McAuliffe, which is not his usual calling card, says, I'm not going to concede. We're not going to say anything until every legal vote is counted. Essentially, it was Donald Trump redux. So, that's another factor that's got to be built into these things. All next year, we're going to hear, are we not, that every single Republican who loses had the election stolen from them, so no one's going to have confidence unless the Republicans win outright. Isn't that real?
Well, haven't you read the Republican Dictionary, which offers a definition of voter fraud? And the definition is,
we lose.
What happens whenever we lose an election?
It's unbelievable.
No, it is incredible. And here's what's troubling for Democrats out of both races. I mean, in both races, Biden carried Jersey by 16 and Virginia by 10, and the Democratic vote collapsed.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it collapsed was that this voter fraud narrative, much as you and I and may bemoan it, and I do, it really seems to motivate the Republican base. There was turnout in sort of rural conservative Youngkin got a share of the vote in turnout that Donald Trump must be very unhappy with, because Youngkin did way better than Trump in places where you didn't think there was any room to improve the Republican vote. And the democracy message just didn't penetrate. The democracy, the threat of Trump message, didn't penetrate quite enough for McAuliffe to pull it through. And so I think there is a lot of thinking to be done about how to talk about these charges of voter fraud in a way that really start engaging people, obviously especially the Democratic base, but everyone else, to say, wait a minute, you know, democracy itself is at issue here, and Republicans are just going to keep claiming voter fraud whenever they lose, and there's really something wrong with that.
May I just offer one more theory on Virginia? Is that, you know, Charlie Baker is the governor in Massachusetts. He's a Republican. He's one of many Republican governors we've elected here. Moderate Republican, obviously, very popular here. Very popular on those surveys, most popular governor in the country and stuff like that. We're obviously a very Democratic state. The Republican Party here is sort of a laughingstock for the most part.
It's like 10% registration.
Yeah. So to me, McAuliffe, I find him so unappealing in almost a visceral way, and I have for a long time. And I know a lot of suburban women that went for Youngkin, that went for Biden before, is that it was partly personality. I mean, Youngkin seems like a non— well, he had a lot of things. I mean, he's opposed to gay marriage, which is a big problem if you believe in that, as I certainly do. But he seemed like a more regular Republican. And Terry McAuliffe, to some people, I can't be the only one who find him almost repellent. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about that.
Well, you know, when a race turns out to be as close as Virginia was, and it really was a couple of points, it wasn't a blowout. It was just the loss. What hit people hard was how much the Democratic vote collapsed. You can ascribe it to anything. And I think it's true that McAuliffe did turn off some people. I must say I have a view of McAuliffe that he is so resolutely himself all the time that I kind of admire his characterological consistency. And there is a kind of enthusiasm there always. But I think what you said is true of an awful lot of voters. And Youngkin, I mean, a lot of Republicans are going to study Youngkin's campaign because he really presented himself as the kind of suburban dad that suburban moms and dads can identify with him. He wore that fleece. He was always carrying a basketball. He just presented himself as characterologically the opposite of Donald Trump, put aside Terry McAuliffe. And if you looked at the ads, especially that they ran up in the part of the state near where I live here in D.C., he looked like a guy you saw on the soccer field or the basketball coach he was to his kids. And I think that did make a difference.
So, E.J., you've mentioned a couple of times voting rights. I think everybody listening to the show knows, because we've discussed it ad nauseum, knows there's got to be at least a carve-out of the filibuster because no Republicans are even willing to debate things like the John Lewis Act or whatever for the people is now called voter freedom or some such thing. I'm assuming when Biden on that CNN town hall said, I'm open to this or some such thing, the reason, which was a good sign, that the reason it hasn't moved is because the White House believes we don't want to throw off the negotiations on Capitol Hill on the Build Back Better thing. Should we assume when that's done, if it is done before Thanksgiving, they move on to this issue? And are there the votes to dump the filibuster for voting rights?
Well, I think you just pointed to another cost of how long it's taken them to get this thing done, because it really squeezes the time they're going to have to get the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act through. And that's going to be difficult, and they've got to pass that quite quickly if they're going to have an impact on the 2022 elections. I have been on the mildly optimistic side of this in the following sense. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, has set this all up in a way to create a path for Joe Manchin to say, I am willing to mess with the filibuster rules because Now, the Senate isn't what it used to be. Schumer has really done a good job. You know, he got Manchin to rewrite the bill, try to sell it to Republicans. Yeah. That failed. And so now Manchin's in a position of letting the filibuster kill a bill that he says we need. But also, the debate has been recast that Schumer's almost turned ending the filibuster into a conservative, small c, conservative argument, which is this thing has been so abused that this isn't the great Senate that Joe Manchin and all the others who have defended the filibuster, including Joe Biden, like to talk about. And that if you want to restore the Senate to a place that can debate and act, you've got to change the current filibuster rule because it's been abused again and again and again. And we will learn soon whether that argument has worked. But I do think Schumer deserves some credit for setting this up in a way that sort of creates this journey for Manchin where he just might get to the point of saying, okay, I'm prepared to change the rules. He has said in the past that there are some rules on the filibuster he was willing to change. So we'll see what happens.
So E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post, before you go, I wanted to talk to you about your column about Pope Francis and President Biden. And I want to preface this by saying we are lucky enough to have Bill McKibben in here, you know, the great environmentalist who's trying to save the world before we poison it to death or strangle it to death or whatever we're doing. And he said the best thing he ever read about climate change was Pope Francis Laudate Si'. Or C. How do you pronounce that? You're a Catholic school boy.
Laudate Si.
Laudate Si. Thank you very much.
You got it right.
Okay.
You're a good Catholic school educated woman.
I'm not.
No,
I'm not. I never went to Catholic school, actually.
Oh,
I don't know.
Gosh.
I don't know what happened. I'm a public school kid.
I made an assumption.
It's okay. It's okay. But in any case, I would bet that the number of Catholics who even know that is very tiny because Catholicism these days seems to be all about, you know, whether you're staying out of trouble with the pedophiles, whether it's abortion and whether it's birth control and those kind of things. And you point out in your column that how interesting it is, how Trumpified American Catholicism has become because the people that can't stand Joe Biden also can't stand Pope Francis. Elaborate on what you said.
Well, two things. Really, everybody should read Laudato Si. It's an amazing document. And Pope Francis is way more radical than Joe Biden. He's way more radical than most Democrats on this. It's a really remarkable document, and it makes sense. This is a guy who picked the name Francis because of Francis of Assisi.
Nice.
I mean, he cares deeply about God's creation, and that's where this whole document comes from. And what you find now that's so disturbing to anybody who's not a really conservative Catholic is that a significant part of the hierarchy, not the entire hierarchy, but probably a majority of it right now, a majority of the bishops who are critical of Pope Francis and they're critical of Joe Biden. And if you wonder why those two men seem to get along so well, it's because they share the same enemies in the hierarchy of the church, because the very conservative and right-wing leaders of the church are really uncomfortable or unhappy or angry about how Pope Francis has shifted. He hasn't abandoned the church's opposition to abortion, but he said, for goodness sake, if you care about life, you've got to care about the environment in which we live. You've got to care about poor people. You've got to care about those moms who bring kids into the world. And that is, in a way, again, to go back to my earlier point, a restoration of where a large part of the church was 30 years ago, before you had this really sharp lurch to the right among American bishops. And so it's very disconcerting for faithful Catholics who don't happen to have right-wing politics.
Yeah, right. It may be, have a lot to do with why the numbers continue to shrink so dramatically.
Right, but especially among young people.
Yeah.
I think this is something that the most conservative sectors of the church really don't want to face up to, which is that young people, they're leaving, let's be fair about this, they're leaving religion in droves generally, but they are really defecting from the Catholic Church. But this, by the way, poses a real problem for more liberal Catholics because the people who mostly might agree with them, particularly young Catholics, are actually leaving the church. And so it's creating a real problem for those who actually support Pope Francis.
E.J. Dionne, great to talk to you as always.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks, E.J.
Great show to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you. E.J. Dionne is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist of the Washington Post. His latest book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save the Country. Thanks again to E.J. Dionne. Coming up, we're opening the lines to ask you about something we spoke with E.J. about. Does anything that happens in American politics change anything anymore? Or are we all too deep in our own news bubbles and silos even to know what good the other side might be achieving? That's next on 89.7 GBH. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Democrats, who control all of Congress and the presidency, have finally passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, as we just discussed with E.J. Dionne, for roads, bridges, and more. Americans overall are in a better financial position than they've been in the last couple of years. Workers themselves have much more leverage to fight for better wages and working conditions. So why do so many of us feel like everything is in the gutter? A new Suffolk USA Today poll paints a brutal landscape for Democrats heading into 2022 as Biden's approval rating drops to 38%. So we're asking you this. What is the state of American political debate, assuming there is any, which I guess is the point? It's sort of like Democrats. I never knew which was which. Democrats are from Venus, Republicans from Mars, whatever that book said. And we're not even talking about the same thing. So we can't debate them again, because we're not talking about any of the same things. The number's 877-301-8970. I don't know if I articulated that adequately, but it is really, you know, it's like they're two separate parallel or not parallel universes, and they never intersect on anything. It's sort of like the line that we asked repeatedly. You know, we credited Donald Trump with the infamous, if I shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, you know, no one would give a damn, wouldn't lose a vote. And I think that proved to be totally true. By the way, you know what I meant to say to you, Dave? Did you know that in rural districts in Virginia, Youngkin won 62-31, 2-1. He won, and I'm sorry, 62-31. Rural voters prefer Donald Trump. I got that backwards, by the way. I didn't mean to say Youngkin, meaning there's still huge support for him, which I guess was where it was before, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. What I guess what we are attempting to talk about here is that there can't even be debate, because one half of the country is in one silo, as you said before, and the other's half in the other. The Democrats are going to spend the next year talking about all the things they've accomplished. Hopefully they accomplish a lot more in the so-called horribly named Build Back Better bill. And the Republicans are going to talk about immigration. We're going to have Ali Noorani on later. And, well, immigration is a cultural issue to a lot of people. And cultural issues. I mean, it really is. And it's almost like, you know, other than an incredible statement that E.J. Dionne said that was as dramatic a moment in a debate, or as damaging as Jerry Ford's thing about Poland
not being a communist country.
Right, McAuliffe, or not controlled. McAuliffe's line about teaching is essentially all the Republicans are going to talk about, and Democrats can do something else. I know I'm not articulating as well as I can, but my frustration level that you can't even have a debate because of how in different worlds people are is immense.
Well, you know, as I said before, you would think, and this gets back to that great book about why does Kansas vote against its self-interest?
What's the matter with Kansas? Thomas Frank.
And his argument was, you know, about why do people vote against their economic self-interest all the time. You would think if your life was improved dramatically by the child care tax credit, if you were getting that child tax credit, that getting that $300 a kid or whatever it is when they're a little bit older every single month, I mean, that could be like $1,000 extra a month. You would think, gee, that's a big deal. I would like that kind of thing to continue. And you would think that you would be interested in, if you get young children with a child care thing, or we've talked a million times about older people with the dental problems and Medicare and stuff. You'd think that that would be a reason for you to be rooting for this social spending thing. But it doesn't seem to translate at all.
Well, you know, but you know, I guess what the problem, let's focus on the one thing you mentioned, the child tax credit, which, by the way, a lot of Republicans use this sport in Congress. It's almost like, I guess what I was trying, you can't even have a debate about it. It is fine to think it's wasteful spending. You'd be wrong if you thought that. If you want to say in response to the Democrats, well, I think it's too much money to spend. And, you know, just like Joe Manchin, who at least is engaging by saying what you said a minute ago, that there should be a $60,000 cap. But there's not even that debate. You know what the Republican response is? Democrats don't want parents to be involved in teaching in school. I'm serious. So it's almost like we're in totally different universes, as I've now said 14 times.
And there was a great story over the weekend. A lot of papers reported on it, this idea that the economy is terrible, even though, as you were saying before, you know, Americans are doing by many measures, better than they have in years, talking about wages growing up, people having much more in their savings account. Unemployment rate is 4.6. We just got an email that says that's not true. The unemployment rate is that much higher, but that's what the government is saying. The unemployment rate is 4.6%. And Americans have accumulated a lot of money. And they're also talking about these huge wages going up because of the pandemic, right? That people can't get hired. But inflation seems to have us all worked into a frenzy that even though unemployment is down, wages are up, and the fact that cars are costing more and gas is costing more,
and
your refrigerator is costing more is causing us to think that we're on the brink of disaster. That's really weird too, isn't it?
877-301-8897. Let's get some calls in here. Ellen in a car. You are first on Boston Public Radio. We hope you can explain it better than we can, Ellen. We're both so flummoxed. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
I probably can't explain it more.
Yes, you can. Go ahead.
Well, one of the big things is a lot of people stayed home. We're not doing service kind of spending. You have more money to spend on stuff that, like, tangible, just stuff, collecting it, blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that I get really upset about is that usually politics, when I was growing up, you had people who, you know, kind of did their own business, got to a certain point in the pillar of the community, and became like around like 50, 55 years old, ready to retire, but also wanted to like still be active. And now it seems like the only people in politics are either ones who are so entrenched and so old, or they are literally the rabble rousers who anybody can just say, all right, I'll just pull that string and he'll say anything. And the rest of us are left in between saying we have these rotten roads, we have everything kind of going against us, where do we turn? And people are getting angry.
Right. There's no place for us in the debate. Ellen, you said it better than we did. Ellen, thanks
for
calling.
Hold on for a second.
Sorry.
Ellen, just want to be sure what when you're saying the people that retired at 55, they retired from their small business jobs and then went into politics.
Yes, exactly. And then they would kind of go into politics and be like, oh, I think I can actually
give back.
Contribute.
Or, right, or they were civically involved, even if they didn't run for office kind of thing.
Exactly. And this is not what we have now. This is literally just.
It's because it's so angry and everybody is so locked into their positions and the unwillingness to sort of find some middle ground, even if it's imperfect, unless Joe Manchin forces you to, is just a thing of the past. Ellen, thanks for the call.
To Ellen's point, Chuck Grassley, 87.
88.
Is he 88 now?
88, yeah.
I think I want to run for another term.
Well, you know, I don't want to get – I often get accused of ageism for saying this, but it's how I feel. Would you, under normal circumstances, whether you love him or hate him, say a 78-year-old should take over the single most difficult pressure-packed job
in
the whole world?
I think it's reasonable to think that you are not at 78 what you were at 58. And, you know, I worry about his – walking. I worry about his energy. I worry about all these things. I mean, you think that part of the reason people think that the president is weak is not just because he's let Joe Manchin run the country, but because he just somehow doesn't have the stamina. And I don't know if that's true, but yeah, absolutely, I worry about it.
Muhammad,
we certainly know that Chuck Grassley, I think it's fair to say without being ageist, that really 90 years old, I mean, who's the guy that was on Star Wars that went up in the spaceship with Jeff Bezos, William Shatner? Is that
his Shatner.
Name? Yeah, William
he's
Shatner.
90 or
yeah,
he's 91 90. Or something.
I would say he's an exception.
He is an exception.
To the rule. You see him doing the commercials.
Well, by the way, Grassley, if he completes his terms, he'll be 94 years old.
Exactly.
I don't even know what that has to do with what we're talking about either.
It has to do with what Ellen said.
What'd she say?
That it's different now. People clinging to power forever and ever and ever.
Mohammed, you're in Providence. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Mohammed. What's up?
Hey, how we doing?
Good.
First, I want to say that as good as the statement from the previous caller was, that's not the reality we live in. So in other words, the Democrats have to win in this current landscape, which means they have to attract their base voters. But you know what? I never thought I'd say this, but I believe there's too many intellects on television, people that went to Harvard. They got too many degrees, and they're very sophisticated. They sound good, you know what I mean? But the bottom line is they don't attract the layman, just like the Republicans. We make fun of the people on Fox News, but they seem to say the things that attract their base voters. The Democrats don't even know how to defend real-life situations.
Well, you know, Mohammed, can I interrupt you for
yeah.
a second? There's a guy who's in the White House who is exactly what you say politicians are not. He's from Scranton, Pennsylvania. He didn't go to an Ivy League school. He's from a working class family. And I think that's – he had two appeals. I think one was that, and two, that he wasn't Donald Trump. So I think he succeeded to the presidency in great part because he was that thing you say doesn't exist, you know?
Can I actually touch on that real quick?
Of course you can.
You know, you're right, but he was running against a madman.
That's a very that's a very fine point, Mohammed. I hadn't thought of that. That's true.
But also,
good.
And I was going to say, you know, the beauty of things like satellite radio, I've gotten to listen to African Americans on radio.
Uh-huh.
And they're saying Joe Biden, as much as they loved him, he's not in the fight. He's not in their fight. They don't see it that way. This is part of the reason they lost that election in Virginia. A lot of black people down there don't feel like these guys, like Biden, are fighting the way they should be fighting, because this thing about voting is existential to black people.
Yeah.
They don't feel like these people are in the fight, because the truth is Joe Biden's 80, I don't know, is he 80 yet?
78.
78, closing in.
78. It doesn't matter what happens, let's be honest. But to the people that voted for him with all their might, that's the reason he's in the White House. He hasn't delivered for them. That election in Virginia is all about black people, nothing else.
Mohammed, that's a great perspective.
Thank you
very much. I especially like your line about the madman. You know, speaking of old people and young people, did you read about how after the climate conference, and they talked about how something like 80% of the people that were running the climate conference were men, mm-hmm. and they were old, and that most of the women...
Well, they're the leaders of most nations.
Well, exactly, but the big protest that was run outside was run by these young
Greta
women
Thunberg.
And a bunch of other young women that were saying, you don't get it. You know, you are not that long for this world, and we're going to be living in the mess that you created. So I thought that was great.
By the way, while we're talking about ageism, which was not where we intended to go, one of our colleagues just told us in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. I'm from Philly. I don't even know of Tinton Falls. The 97-year-old mayor was reelected. We want to congratulate him or her, and that person will be 102 when his or her term ends. You know, when I started this conversation, I did it really inartfully. Basically, the topic we're discussing is what a total mess American politics is, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum. And that's really what callers are responding to. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Salem. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi. I agree that politics is a mess. But the reason I'm calling is that despite that, I feel like there's a lot of talk about Democrats and their messaging and how terrible it is. And I kind of agree that it's not ideal. But, you know, around these bills, the media has just been talking about the conflicts between the Democrats, the drama with Manchin and Sinema. And I buy into that, too. But they did get something done. And there's a reason why none of us know what's in it. And it's because we've all been talking about that, and the media hasn't really been telling us what's in it.
Excellent
and that's
point.
Kind of the media's job.
Excellent point.
You know, and these two close races, I think it's, this is not, I don't know if you know who Rebecca Solnit is. She's a feminist writer.
No.
She writes for The Guardian periodically.
Mm-hmm.
And she recently wrote an article talking about, you know, the narrative is always the Democrats lost even when they won. The Republicans can't lose. They just don't lose. It's always stolen from them, or they didn't, you know, they didn't really lose. They won tremendously in Virginia, but, you know, it was a squeaker in New Jersey. And, you know, McAuliffe was an uninspired candidate.
That's Marjorie's position.
And
there's a lot of reasons why he didn't win.
But Linda, can I interrupt you to say you and Marjorie agree on that? And I'll say respectfully to both of you, it doesn't matter. All that matters is he lost. The Democrat lost. And you weren't listening earlier, I don't think, when I mentioned a great piece by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, who made the point, not as well as you are, actually, but he talked about the fact that the margin of victory in New Jersey and Virginia was the exact same. In Virginia, McAuliffe, with grace, conceded and congratulated the winner, and losing by the exact same margin in New Jersey, Cittarelli, I think his name is, challenged whether or not they were legitimate results and said he wouldn't concede until all the, quote, legal votes were counted, implying that there were illegal votes, a la Donald Trump. So your point is right on.
I did read that article, and that's right from the Republican playbook.
Yep.
But I think what's interesting is that, you know, what we want to call mainstream, or, you know, some people call liberal media, the narrative is, you know, we got sacked in Virginia. I mean, they're promoting that a different narrative, which is we got clobbered in Virginia and we barely managed to hang on in New Jersey. But that's not really, I mean, is that really what happened when they were both so close? Is that really the takeaway?
Well, I think I actually think it is. But I think your larger point is a wonderful one. And Linda, thank you for the call. You know what Linda's talking about? We did. And we're as guilty as some others are, except, do you remember a couple of weeks ago we did one of my favorite shows we've done in months, is when we talked about, I think it was the child care provision, and who called in cold, her staff, I assume, was just listening to the show.
Elizabeth Warren.
Yep. And explained the thing. And we spent most of an hour fleshing out a really important provision of the so-called Build Back Better law. So Linda makes a wonderful point. We are part of the enemy on this issue.
Well, Joe just emailed this part of the same thing. He said, give me a break. Biden just passed a huge bipartisan bill. Let's give him a little credit. And it is a big deal. And here it just...
No. Let me respond to that email.
Yep.
That is my point.
Yep.
I don't think it matters to even those who benefit from it. And you would think, what's the emailer's name?
Joe.
Wouldn't you think, Joe, there'd be some people this morning who would say I was critical of Biden until Friday morning, and now because the bridge in my community is going to be filled, broadband access is going to be extended to my neighbor in Western Massachusetts, that they'd flip? I don't think anybody flips. So you're right, but the impact, I guess, is what we're talking about.
Well, since we never talked, our staff gave us a little synopsis here of the infrastructure bill. So as long as people are saying what's in it, what is in it, it's not as much funding as people hope for, but the funding for those, just as you just mentioned, Jim, roads and bridges, transit and rail, broadband upgrade, airports, ports and waterways. And by the way, one of the big reasons that we're having this terrible backup of all these goods and services, the so-called supply chain, is because so many of the ports are in such disrepair from years of not taking care of them. Lots of money for electric vehicles, which is a very big deal, because if people buy electric vehicles, obviously there'll be a lot less pollution coming, all these millions of cars driving on every day, improving power and water systems. That's another big deal, because you read all these stories endlessly. It's not just Flint, Michigan that's got problems with water. It's a lot of places have problems with the water. How many times do you read you have to boil water because there's terrible stuff in the water you're drinking is going to make you sick? And 21, there's stuff for environmental stuff, not nearly enough, but cleaning up Superfunds, brownfield sites, not nearly enough. But there is a lot of good stuff. My fear is that this is so watered down. And the other one is going to be so watered down, assuming it even passes, is that the impact is going to be on the margins and not big enough.
Which person of this, of the 38%, we got to take a break, but 38% gave approval to Joe Biden when a family that is going broke over child care expenses, and this is the point I was trying to make 20 minutes ago, finds out that they're going to save, I'll make up a number, $6,000 next year on child care. Are they all of a sudden going to say, I was right then, but Joe Biden did deliver. I'm not going to. I would say virtually none of those people are, because everybody is so locked into their damn position.
I know. Well, it's like the what's the matter with Kansas theory, that when programs are going to help you, you would think you'd want to continue with those programs. But that's what we're questioning, whether that even happens anymore. Anyway, we're talking about your outlook on about the state of the nation. We're going to keep talking about it when we return. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. I think to sum up where we're trying to take this conversation, to read the Democratic congressman who said the whole debate about the two bills in the House was a cluster blank. That's essentially what I'm trying to say about the state of American political debate, and we're taking your calls, some of which are wide-ranging, but I think it's because we didn't focus the issue as well as we might have. Let's go to Woburn, where Edson is on the phone. Edson, it's very nice of you to call. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a long-time listener, frequent caller. And one thing I always say here, Jim, before you hit the mute button, is thank you for giving us a voice. So please hear my voice. I have two quick points to make.
Sure.
The first thing that needs to happen is to pass a law to protect voters' rights, because this is so-called a democracy in all these Republican states passing laws trying to suppress the vote. So how are we any different from Nicaragua, where the guy declared himself as president on an election that everybody knows that's fraudulent? Here, we had the same thing. We had violent counter action from the government, from the previous government, against protests, the peaceful protests. So how are we any different from these other countries where we're trying to impose democracy on them? The other point that I want to make is, it's simple how to fix this problem. Term limits. We need term limits for senators and the Supreme Court, because if these guys are allowed to stay there for life, they are out of control. You know, Jim, I'm all in favor of ageism, because that gives you experience, but not life terms for anyone. These guys keep getting reelected. That should be a limit, and that's how you take care of this problem, because and also, what do you do about those rogue politicians, such as Manchin and Sinema, that are holding an entire half of the country votes for Democrats? Those senators are representing those people. Because
actually,
one of their arguments
much is more than half of the country voted for Democrats in Congress. Yes. Yeah.
So he's saying, I'm defending my constituents. What about the other 48 senators? What do they do to defend their constituents?
Well, Ed said, can I respond to your thing? Marjorie's a big term limits fan. I've always been against them. I have to say, I could be convinced these days. The problem for you and Marjorie is, I believe, for there to be term limits of members of Congress, the members themselves would have to vote to amend the Constitution. I believe I'm right about that. That's never going to happen. In terms of the Supreme Court, where I totally agree with you, Congress could impose those limits just with a simple vote. I'm quite sure I'm right about that. And they have chosen not to. But Edson, thanks for the call. You're a big term limits person. Do you agree with them?
Well, I do. I mean, the difficulty of getting it done is absolutely right. But I do think if there were term limits, then in your last term, when you didn't have to run again, you might actually vote your conscience instead of voting for what lobbyists wanted you to do. Or you
might vote for your next employer.
You could.
Because you know that you don't have to be beholden to your constituents.
There's a lot of reforms, the so-called revolving door between Congress and these kinds of jobs you're talking about. You know, if you're voting for the war and then going to get a job in Halliburton, I suppose that would be a problem right after you left your congressional seat. But money in politics is the other big thing, and I don't know. It's just not term limits now. It's many things, but I don't know if we're ever going to get there. Rama from Magnolia, thank you for calling.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
Hey there.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you.
So you say it's a mess. I don't know what party my mayor is of the town of it's actually Gloucester. Magnolia's part of Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what party my city councilors are, and I don't much care. I am a devout independent, and 53 to 55% of the voters in Mass, and maybe in the country, are independent. Maybe 30%, 35% Democrat, 15 to 20% Republican. So on the local level, they get stuff done irregardless of party.
Yeah.
You get to the state level, you start to do party. You get to the federal level, you start to do Democrats and Republicans. Linda, who called a little while ago, talked about we. Like people talk about the Patriots. Oh, we are going to win this. We. So it's the Democrat-Republican battle. It doesn't have to be. If we're independent, it won't matter. Just get stuff done, please.
Well, you know, Rama, thank you for the call. I'm so glad you called, because one of the hopeful things is what can happen locally in cities. And I mean, there are more Dems versus Republicans in the states, but cities and states seem to be much higher functioning these days in the federal government, and whether it's climate change or on a lot of other initiatives.
They're doing great on limiting people's right to vote. They're really effective on that. They're great on limiting women's right to reproductive freedom. You're right. They're very
it's
effective.
Not everything, Jim, but I do think it's the
I think it used to be the case. I think it used to be the case. I think
the cities and states can do more now than the federal government?
I think some states can do more, but
yeah.
Their power, because the federal government and the Congress on many issues has ceded the ground, like on voting rights, is doing half the states are doing really dangerous things. So I guess it depends. What Rama and you were saying depends on how you feel about the outcomes. By the way, it's not just in Gloucester. You don't run by party in Boston. You don't run by party in Cambridge, I assume. You don't run by party for select people in Brookline. You don't.
No, the party's not an issue, although when was the last time a Republican won much of anything in Boston?
Well, I agree, but they don't run. I mean, his point is that they're not running. I think his point is they're not running under a party label, which he believes, I guess, is a positive thing.
You know, more in doubt.
By the way, I just want to confirm, I did look up, the Constitution would have to be amended for their term, therefore, to be term limits for members of Congress, which means a supermajority of members of Congress themselves would have to vote to limit their own terms to start the process.
You know, Amanda emailed a while ago. She said she's a liberal who finds herself moving more and more to the left because the left, including us, that would be you and me, Jim, very much categorizes and talks down to anyone who holds an opposing view. You hear that kind of complaining a lot. Maureen Dye wrote this column over the weekend that you alerted me to. I missed it. I apologize. Wokeness derails the Democrats, and she's talking about the left going too far and the Democratic Party alienating a lot of so-called middle-of-the-road Democrats. I mean, that could be a significant issue, too.
Well, let me quote my second favorite pundit, you.
Mm-hmm.
What the Democrats are looking for in Congress, if you go on the list, is not on-the-fringe kinds of things. Virtually every single thing in both of these bills is about as mainstream as you can get. You could argue that you shouldn't spend that much money, that it's going to cause inflation. That's fine. But you can't argue that these are extremist kinds of positions.
But they're talking more cultural issues, wokeness on cultural issues.
Okay.
And I think that could be, you know, there's an all or nothing on some of these issues that I think is incorrect, because many people see themselves as being in the middle. But in any case, we are moving on. Mayor Janey, who's run the city of Boston for these recent months, is going to be with us, Kim Janey, to reflect on her historic tenure as the first woman and the first black woman to run the city of Boston. We're going to talk about her tenure, and we're going to talk about what's ahead, and we're going to talk about the transition between her and the new elected mayor, Michelle Wu, all that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, in a couple minutes, we'll be joined by Boston's Mayor Kim Janey here to reflect on her tenure, which the Boston Globe's Janae Oster held, called short but historic. She'll also talk about her plans for the future and how she's preparing for the transition to Mayor-elect Michelle Wu in 8 short days. Then she'll be followed by Michael Curry, CEO of the Mass League of Community Health Centers, on the latest efforts to tame COVID and move toward true health equity.
The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price will be back to navigate the latest moral quandaries of the day, including what some prominent black Republicans had to say following the GOP wins in last week's elections, and the debate among healthcare workers on getting that elusive religious exemption on vaccines, plus some details in their latest All Revved Up podcast titled, Why Did I Get Married? Millions are asking that question. All that is ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Before we start,
yes,
I just want to say again that we are going to be, for the first time in months, back at the Boston Public Library tomorrow.
We are.
So if you're in the neighborhood, stop by and say hello. We'll be there from 11 to 2, and we're going to be there next few Tuesdays of the month.
We are. And by the way, we would urge you to come. If you're coming tomorrow, come closer to 11, because as we know, the sun goes down at about 12:30. So... because of this horrible time shift. Joining us in the studio, I had to explain myself, is someone who's made history in Boston. You know this. As the first woman, first black person to lead the city, Mayor Kim Janey. She's here to reflect on her tenure, talk about challenges going ahead, and a whole host of things. Mayor Janey, it's really good to see you. Thanks for being here.
It is great to be here with you. Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you.
By the way, she's in the studio. You are physically presence, and we in yours,
well,
which we
love. Remember when we first interviewed you, when you first took over as the mayor, we were all in a massive room down the hallway, like all 20 feet apart, so nobody would be breathing on anybody. I think that was pre-vaccine days, right, where we all had to be so nervous.
I may have had my first shot. I'm not sure I was fully vaccinated, but right now I've had my booster. So
have we. You know, we didn't intend to get into this, but since we just mentioned that, before we talk about you, which is really what we want to do today, what is the state of our climbing out of COVID in the city, would you say, Mayor?
Well, I am not a scientist, so I'm not a future teller, but we've done great work over the last eight months getting folks vaccinated. So I can't predict whether or not there'll be more variants that come, but we know that our best protection is the vaccine. It's the best way to protect ourselves and those that we love. And so right now in the city of Boston, we've got 74% that have at least one shot in the arm. We've got kids now who are eligible for the vaccine. We've got a plan in place to make sure we're getting our young people vaccinated. And Boston is one of the most vaccinated big cities in the country. So I'm really proud of what we've been able to do on that front.
That is great. So Mayor Janey, you just got a few more days left as the mayor. How do you take advantage of those last few days? You invite everybody you know over to the beautiful office there at Faneuil Hall? Or what do you do for you, to
you
wrap
know,
this up?
It is really, for me, just trying to continue to focus on the people of Boston, making sure that we are doing everything possible to ensure a smooth transition with the next administration. Very little time to do even more work as mayor of Boston, like extend the free bus pilot that I announced earlier this summer. We're working on extending that. There are other things that we want to get in place before the next administration comes in. And so it's really just trying to continue to focus on the work and the people of Boston.
What are some of the kinds of things? By the way, when you mentioned the bus, do you remember the first time you were with us as mayor when that guy, I think his name was Barry, I can't believe it's coming back to me.
I think it was Bruce.
Bruce, it was Bruce. He said, I'll see you on the 28th. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I don't know if you and he ever connected. What are the things you're trying to button up or finish in the next 8 days?
Yeah, well, it's extending that. It's making sure that the work that we are doing to support people with substance abuse or substance use disorder, that is still our priority in terms of using a public health lens. We're a week into the encampment protocol, so it's making sure that we're doing that work. There is more work to do in terms of our schools and supporting young people. This is their third year being impacted by COVID, their third school year. And so making sure that our young people are off to a good start.
Can I go back to the first one for a second?
Yeah.
Were you suggesting that in the next 8 days you're going to expand the free bus program?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
To what?
We're at least through the end of the year, and certainly
great.
I know that this is a priority for Mayor-elect Wu, so I'm hoping that she will be able to build upon this work. But yes, we want to make sure that we're right now in communication with the MBTA, making sure that we're getting the negotiations completed so that we can extend through the end of the year.
That's
great. So Jenny Osterhelt, who writes a great column for the Boston Globe, Beautiful Resistance, she did a story about you and talked about the fact that, I'm old enough to remember I was in a state of shock when Tom Menino was elected. And my God, I'm Irish, but this is Italian. I mean, what is this? And then you come along all these years later, and you're a woman and you're a black woman. She talked about how much that mattered to see a woman arriving at places, black woman, getting out of the mayoral SUV, whatever you guys drive around in now, holding these. You must have gotten a sense of that constantly during your tenure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, first, I never expected to see a black mayor, never expected to see me as the first black mayor. And I think it meant an awful lot to the people of Boston who felt the same way. It was, for them, I think, recognition that we've come a long way. And when I think about it personally myself, it comes literally 45 years after being on that school bus, as one of the kids who was on the front lines to desegregate Boston Public Schools. And to see, you know, what this meant in terms of little girls and little boys and older black women and men, to see the first black mayor, it meant everything. And it does demonstrate that we've come a long way, but we've got to be focused on the work. And that work is racial equity work and making sure, because we can't just talk about symbolism. We've got to talk about the substance. And the work is making sure that we are moving our city forward, that we're tackling long-standing issues as it relates to who has access to power, who's being brought in, and what decisions we make, and how we use a racial justice lens to move everyone forward in our city. Boston, as I've said, is a great, great city. It's a world-class city. It's my home. I love my city, but it has not historically worked for everyone. And so we've got to make sure that we're closing those gaps.
Well, you say you never expected to see a black mayor. A lot of people in the city, not just black people, are upset that we didn't see a black elected mayor. They may think Michelle Wu will do a terrific job, but there was a lot of dissatisfaction when you, John Barros, and Andrea Campbell got, 40-some percent of the vote, yet none of the three black candidates made the final. In retrospect, do you regret that there wasn't some sort of Wakanda 2 kind of deal where there was a single major black candidate, or was that... And by the way, when people respond to that by saying everybody's got a right to run, of course everybody has a right. That's not the issue. Strategically, would that have been a wiser choice? Because most people think if either you or Campbell had decided to support the other person, one of you either would be mayor, but at least have been in the final.
Well, so let me tackle the first piece that you mentioned, which was the disappointment. And certainly there is a lot of disappointment in the black community and communities of color, that a black candidate did not advance to the final. And certainly as someone who was running, I was disappointed as well. You know, I wanted to serve for a full term. I do believe that everyone has a right to vote. And in terms of, I guess, the Wakanda 2 reference, there wasn't one black candidate in that DA's race. There were three black mm-hmm. candidates in that DA's race. There were three women who were running, and we still elected a black person and a woman as DA. And did we want to see that here in this race? I'm sure lots of folks in the city of Boston wanted to see that. I'm proud that I was able to dominate in communities of color and won those precincts outright. That being said, what we had move forward were two women, and we now have Mayor-elect Wu. I was proud to support her early when she advanced to the final to make sure that she would carry on and build upon the equity and justice work that I've been able to do over the last 8 months and really tackle these long-standing, persistent challenges that continue to confront the city of Boston.
Did you get any specific commitments from... you endorsed her pretty quickly, and I think a lot of people, myself included, were surprised at the speed with which you endorsed her. Did you get any specific commitments
from
her?
Well, I've had the pleasure of working with Wu on the council. We've worked together on a number of issues. One that I got to sign into law just, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, something that we worked on together, and advanced through the council. And so I'm proud of the work that we've done. I know that she will continue to build and lead as it relates to equity and making sure that we are doing things differently in the city of Boston to bring more people into the fold, to include of folks and to tackle these long-standing gaps, whether we are talking about the racial wealth gap, whether we're talking about the life expectancy gap by zip code, that is 30 years, whether we're talking about opportunity gaps in our schools. I know that she will continue to be focused on those issues and build upon that work.
Did you get any commitments from her?
I got a commitment to do just that.
But that's, I don't mean to disparage that in the slightest, but that's sort of like a rhetorical commitment to, I mean, I assume every candidate of the five of you said, I'm going to try to deal with these race and class disparities in the city. Did she say to you, I'll hire these four people?
Wasn't looking for some sort of transactional, hire this particular person. Every mayor has to build their own team, and I'm sure that she will put together a great team who will serve the city of Boston. What I am looking for in terms of specifics, as are many folks in the Black community, are what is this going to mean in terms of Black home ownership? What is this going to mean in terms of making sure we are dealing with the opportunity gaps in our schools? What is this going to mean in terms of vaccine rollout and ensuring that we are closing these racial gaps? Now, you know, we've done a lot of great work getting Boston residents vaccinated, and we've done great work in lifting up vaccination rates among the Latino community and the Black community, but gaps still persist in all of this. And so we've got to make sure that we're focused on that. And I know that Mayor-elect Wu will continue that good work.
You know, a couple more things about the breakthrough things about your being the not just the first African-American woman mayor, but also we talked to you about this before. You were a teen mom. You know, you hear so often, oh, my God, you know, you have a kid, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's it. You know, your life is over. But obviously your life was not over, and you left college in part because of money issues, which everybody says, well, not everybody, but many people say, oh, well, your life is over. So your life was over twice, and then you wound up being the mayor. I mean, that is, your story is unusual.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
And, you know, and my life was over probably more than two times. I don't know. Was another thing that was really significant about me leading the city, not just as the first woman and the first Black mayor, was that my own lived experience was very much was unlike any of my predecessors. Not just that I come at this being a Black woman, but what I've had to overcome in terms of food insecurity, housing insecurity, being a young single mom, and all of the challenges that come with that. And it was those lived experiences that really informed how I led and how I governed as mayor of Boston, and wanting to make sure that we were doing things that would really help folks in our city, particularly those who are really hard hit because of COVID. And we know that COVID just exposed and exacerbated what was there already under the surface. And so making sure that we were tackling those longstanding issues. So on the one hand, it was coming in and trying to provide stability, comfort. You know, we said goodbye to one mayor who was well-liked. We've got to make sure that our city, in terms of just basic city services and making sure that we're dealing with this pandemic, that we're taking care of the people of Boston, providing that stability, that comfort, but also as a catalyst for change and making sure that all of those issues that were just under the surface, things that I had already been a longtime advocate trying to dismantle, you know, structural racism, and making sure that we were doing things in such a way that really brought people into the fold. It's why, you know, focused on a joy agenda. It's why we did open houses, bringing people into the mayor's office who historically have felt left out of power, from young people, from people from BIPOC communities, from seniors, just folks who only come to City Hall to pay a parking ticket and have some negative experience. How do we open things up and bring people into the fold?
How differently were you treated in these 8 months than from when you were a city councilor?
Great being mayor. you know, it's
Your
great
Excellency,
being mayor.
I should have said. I meant to say.
you know, I will say this, though. The people who work for the city, my team has been amazing. Many of the folks, as you guys know, I inherited from a previous administration. Mm-hmm. I brought some of my own folks in. We had to quickly form one team and to continue to do the work on behalf of the people of Boston. I am really proud of the work that we've done. I'm proud of...
What are you proudest of? What are the things you go to bed at night and you say, I really got that one exactly as I wanted to? And what's the flip side? What are the things on reflection, if you had a do-over, you might have done differently?
Yeah, I think it's the two things that I mentioned earlier, which is really providing stability and comfort at a time where... Yeah. Who knew what was going to happen? Yeah. And nobody ever anticipated like a Delta variant coming. Mm-hmm. But that's the one thing. And then the second thing is really moving us forward in terms of our racial equity work and making sure that we were tackling home ownership. And so expanding down payment assistance for first-time home buyers and quadrupling that down payment from $10,000 to $40,000 was important work, making sure that we were doing more around rental relief, the vaccine verification for city workers, making sure that we were leading. And by the way, the U.S. government has adopted our model in terms of what we did with vaccine verification for the city of Boston. So leading the way there.
What is it?
Well, it's a worker-centered approach where folks have to upload proof of vaccination or they have to submit to regular testing.
Okay.
You know, we were the first in the Commonwealth to lead with a mask mandate for our school children. All of those things, but also making sure that we're doing much more around the racial justice, racial equity work.
What'd you screw up? No, let's. Okay. What'd you?
Well, you know, I would have liked to have had a successful campaign.
No, I understand. But in turn, I'm serious. And I mean, we all do, and I'm sure you've had these moments too, when you did something, and either that night or a week later, you say to yourself, "I really wish I had handled that question or that issue or the what." There had to be things like that.
Well, I think you know, I've said this before. I can't remember if I said this the last time that I was here, related to the vaccine. I think how I expressed my concerns around equity and what it would mean to ask people to prove their vaccination. Just to do basic things like going to the grocery store, I think I could have expressed that in a different way. I think the way I did express it, the equity argument got lost, unfortunately.
We did criticize you for that, by
I'm
the way.
Sure
the
you did, of Jim. I'm sure you
there.
Did.
We did,
I'm
Mayor
sure
Jane,
you
yes.
did. I have no doubts there. But, you know, I think, you know, you take those things and you learn from them. And so then you want to make sure that you are providing great care. So, for example, last month, the Public Health Commission, at my request, has declared a public health crisis as it relates to opioid use and homelessness in the city of Boston. I did a companion executive order, and we've taken, a lot of steps to make sure that we were approaching this with a public health lens, making sure that we weren't allowing folks to continue to talk about tents and encampments when the real issue are people who may be at the lowest point in their lives who need support and treatment. And in the 1 week since we've implemented our protocol, we've helped close to 70 people find housing and treatment. The vast majority of those 70 people, or 66 people to be exact, have found their way into either permanent housing or shelters or treatment, residential treatment.
But how do you react to the Civil Liberties Union lawsuit saying that there are some people who were taken out of there who didn't have adequate housing or facilities to meet their needs?
One, we will obviously follow the guidance of the courts with whatever the courts determine. Two, I'm not going to comment on specifics of the lawsuit or any litigation, but I would say in terms of the steps that we've taken and the work that we are doing, it is very much using a public health approach, treating people with dignity and respect. No one is being asked to leave without adequate housing options for them. So a bed that is appropriate for them, without notice, without a place to store their belongings, and to treat them with that kind of respect. that enforcement comes as a last resort, that all of these other touches would have happened. And in the week that we've been operating, no one has been arrested due to our encampment protocol. Arrests that have happened have been due to warrants that existed, mm-hmm. you know, drug trafficking, human trafficking, things of that sort.
Well, you know, you've talked a lot about equity here, racial equity. I think a lot of us know that Boston is a very segregated city. I was surprised. Well, I wasn't really surprised, I guess. But these cell phone numbers that the Globe talked about last week that indicated where people go in Boston was basically saying white people never go to Dudley or Nubian Square. They never go to Grove Hall. Black people never go to South Boston or the Financial District. Not never, but very rarely. And I wondered... And that's probably pretty true. I wondered what your reaction is to that, both as a kid who grew up in Roxbury and as someone who's been mayor.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't surprising to me. You see it as someone who does go all over our city and not just as mayor of Boston. I often would go to places and be the only one. So, I was not surprised to see that there were some places where in Boston that black people didn't go regularly and other places that white people didn't go regularly. I think we know that, unfortunately, our city remains very segregated in terms of housing and therefore our schools remain very segregated. But I will say that we have made a lot of progress as a city in terms of trying to move past not just the reputation, but the reality, and trying to build those bridges. And so we saw folks do great work over the summer down on the lawn on D. And so there are all kinds of attempts to be a bridge and to bring people together in a different kind of way.
So what are you doing?
Immediately, so we know that it's just days away when I turn over, I want to say the reins, but
we know
the mayor's office to our mayor-elect, Wu, and Wu will become mayor on Tuesday. I'm going to get some rest. I'm going to travel. Get some rest.
Where are you going?
I'm going to keep it local, and I'm going to keep it quiet. I'm not going to disclose where I'll go, but I do hope to do get some rest, do some reflection, and do some writing.
Do you know what you're doing next? I mean,
I'm going to be a resource, for the next administration. I will be available for Mayor-elect Wu once she becomes mayor. Folks often forget that there's also a transition for District 7, and so I will be supporting that work as well for Councilor-elect Anderson, who I think is also amazing. And then I am thinking about next steps, and I'll certainly share those with you.
Would you consider a position in the Wu administration?
I'm going to take the time I need to rest and reflect and write.
There's a book here, I think. I think there's a book here.
There's definitely a book.
I think there is,
Definitely a book, so I am
Absolutely.
Working on a book.
So it's possible.
You
didn't make eye contact when I asked the question, which led me to believe that you didn't want to answer the question.
Well, I think the immediate next steps are for rest, reflection,
Good.
And writing.
You deserve it.
She could be a bestseller. She could be in the New York Times bestseller. That could be a movie.
I think she's in
the movie.
Hey, I'm going to hire Marjorie.
She knows what she's doing.
Exactly.
Trust me.
Yeah,
we
look,
wish you a lot of luck, and
no
we offer you
doing,
hearty
actually.
Congratulations.
I appreciate the
really
opportunity.
Really good to have you here. We hope you're not a stranger in the future.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity. It's great to
Mayor
see you guys.
Mayor Jane, thank you
great
very, very you much too, for being with us. We really appreciate it. And congratulations for changing a lot in the city of Boston. Coming up, a push from the legislature to save local hospitals with stronger oversight over healthcare expansions. Michael Curry will join us to discuss that. He is next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Mardrigan. Join us online to discuss the latest in the fight against COVID beyond the borders of Boston, as we do with Mayor Janey, and how to achieve health equity is Michael Curry. Michael's the president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, member of Governor Baker's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. He's also a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, where he chairs the board's Advocacy and Policy Committee. Michael, good to speak with you.
Good to be back.
We thought we.
What were you deciding whether it was good to be back? Is that why there was a pause? You couldn't make up your mind, or what?
I think that must be a technical issue.
Okay,
technical
issue. I feel better
technical
about that.
Issue.
Okay, great.
Okay, Michael. So we always get the update from you on COVID. What's the state of affairs, and what do you think about these antiviral pills?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we know that technology evolves, right? So we know that the researchers, the pharmaceutical companies are all in a race to come up with the next treatment that will allow people to not be hospitalized and not die from COVID-19. So we had great news this past week. One, that there is a new treatment coming out from Pfizer that is a pill. And then Merck has a pill that is also effective, 50% effective, whereas the Pfizer pill is about 90% effective.
Amazing,
with the
yeah.
population. So here's why this matters. And this is some context that your listeners should hear. There were always treatments that we were unsure of, these infusion therapies that people would get during the early parts of this pandemic. You may have seen Donald Trump had an infusion therapy
yeah.
early in this, right?
Like remdesivir for people, right? Yeah.
Monoclonal antibodies, yeah. remdesivir. Some of it was really speculative about how effective it was early on, and DPH and the governor and administration was getting that information and then trying to get those treatments into communities across the Commonwealth. Now, I'll tell you, and something I don't think I've ever said on your program, that process across the country wasn't really equitable. Because the challenge is many of our communities didn't have the home infusion therapy, the local infusion therapy to get these treatments into the bodies of folks across the Commonwealth. So typically, if you're more well-to-do and you have access, you could gain access to monoclonal antibodies or remdesivir. Fortunate for us in Massachusetts, we're probably better than most of the rest of the country of making these treatments available. That being said, we didn't do a good job across the country. So if you are Black, brown, immigrant, poor, rural, you may not even have heard of remdesivir or monoclonal antibodies. That being said, these pills are game changers, because now what they found was once they give you this pill, if you've not even been vaccinated, they give you this pill within 3 to 5 days. The effectiveness was pretty phenomenal. 90%, as I mentioned. No deaths, zero deaths out of almost close to 800 people in these studies. So they're going to fast track this to see if we can get this out. Doesn't mean you don't get a vaccine. It means you still need to get a vaccination, but it means that we have another tool to prevent more hospitalization and deaths.
You know, when you say game changer a second ago, I think the only other person we've discussed this with is Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. But I know that the Merck pill, which is slightly less effective, as you mentioned, Michael, is before the FDA. I don't know what the timetable is. The Pfizer organization has yet to submit their trial results, or whatever you call it, to the FDA to start the emergency use authorization process. But game changer is an understatement. It seems to me that while I, like you and like everybody else who is sane, hopes that everybody gets vaccinated, and this is just a backup, you know, whether it's for breakthroughs or whatever it is, once these are approved, even the irresponsible, I know you don't use that word, it's me, irresponsible, unvaccinated, are not at the same level of risk that they were before. It's almost like the beginning of the end in a positive way, not a negative way. That's true, isn't it?
It is true. I think you're right. I use the term game changer, what let's more appropriately call it lifesaver.
Really?
Because what these pills represent is that it keeps you from dying. And we know the tens of millions of folks who've not gotten the vaccine. We're moving the needle on that with some creative, innovative campaigns, both here and across the country, to get more and more people to understand the efficacy and safety of these vaccines. And that work should continue. I've said this before on your program and elsewhere, people don't trust the healthcare system and health generally, because we've not been trustworthy. So we have to gain that trust and put that data out. That being said, if you are a person and you're not vaccinated and you get symptoms, you start to get ill, what we're finding with these pills is it's going to have a greater chance of saving your life. That should be news that we all celebrate.
Can I just be really, really clear here? Because I don't want to be as irresponsible as I may have sounded. Neither of these are available yet.
Right.
Neither of these have been demonstrated by the appropriate governmental authorities. They haven't signed off on them yet. So for those who were sort of still on the fence about vaccines, this could be months and months until these are available. So please don't rely on these potentially great antiviral pills until their reality. We're speaking to Michael Curry, who's head of the League of Community Health Centers in Massachusetts.
Michael, one of our colleagues, Mike Dean, had a piece about the House Speaker Ron Mariano wanting to help local hospitals, and he wants to have stronger oversight for health care expansion. You correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what happens is that when these big hospitals, partners, Mass General, Brigham, Beth Israel, the costs go up when they get together and local hospitals are hurt. Is that basically what's going on here?
Well, you know, one, credit to the speaker. Speaker Mariano and I've talked many times about many different issues, and the fact that he is as passionate as he is, because he represents a community with a community hospital. He's passionate around addressing the fact that many of our community hospitals are operating, like many health centers, are operating with thin operating margins, low days cash on end. And what we don't realize as a community is if certain circumstances hit some of our community hospitals, we could lose them, as we've seen across the state and we've seen across the country. Those thin operating margins and low days cash on end put all of our access to healthcare at risk. As a health center person, I'll tell you, I don't want a community hospital in my community dying or going away, because that creates a gap for access to services, and it does impact the community at large. That being said, Speaker Mariano is engaged in this conversation around looking at the evolution, the growth of our healthcare system, including the hospitals, the mergers, acquisitions, the growth and development of those hospitals, and has the right people at the table to have these really complex conversations. We know that we need our larger systems because they do great things and they're helping provide care, access, and resources. We know that we need community hospitals and that they're dying. Credit to Steve Walsh, good friend of mine, graduated New England School of Law with Steve at Mass Hospital Association. He's leading that charge to make sure he represents his constituency and the hospital network. We need to come into the table and have this critical conversation. It's a tough one, and credit to Mariano for leading it.
You know, without getting lost in the weeds, I've done a bunch of forums and panels for the Mass Association of Health Plans, and almost always one of the panelists is David Seltz, who's the executive director of something called the Mass Health Policy Commission, which I find to be a remarkable resource. Part of is what Mariano is trying to do is to give more power to things like the Health Policy Commission, for example, to hold off consolidations or mergers. And by the way, the big boys all say that it lowers prices, Marjorie. Those who don't like them, and I happen to side with that group, feel it raises prices because they're, obviously there's less competition. Is that what Mariano's trying to do, is give more power to stop these mergers when they're not in the public's or the patient's interests?
Well, the piece that he recently posted and published, which I think speaks to this, it calls for the state to strengthen its existing review processes to promote a more balanced market. One tool in particular that he is looking at successful in the past, but looks at those situations like Quincy Medical Center winding down operations. And he opposed the partners' healthcare efforts to acquire three community hospitals. So he's in the weeds of figuring out what this means between all the different players. But yeah, he is. We are a heavily regulated commonwealth for a reason, right? We regulate because we want to control, manage costs, ensure affordability, make sure that there's choice and access. And Mariano is on that end of looking at greater regulatory oversight for some of these mergers, acquisitions, and growth. And I think you'll find that people fall all along that spectrum. But again, we all have a shared interest and passion for the result, which is bringing down costs, making sure care is affordable, giving people choice, and making sure there's quality healthcare.
You know, Michael Curry, we just had in studio, and we hope you're in studio soon, too, by the way. We had Kim Janey, probably the last time we'll talk to her as the mayor of Boston, just 8 days away from the swearing-in of Michelle Wu. She used the term health equity, and you're sort of Mr. Health Equity in Massachusetts, co-chair of the statewide commission. We've talked to you about it a lot, and involved in the city commission. Where's this going? I mean, if you could give a short summary for those who think they hear the term health equity and just think it means health equity within the healthcare system. Obviously, it's not how you see it. You see it in a much more holistic, broader kind of way. Please describe the efforts for those who've missed them. And two, are they going anywhere or is it just high profile announcements and then the powers that be move on?
Well, I say it's a, you know, I ask the question, is this a moment or a movement?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm still trying to figure that out myself. Here's what I would say is I've never seen a moment like this in Massachusetts, a moment where you have as many Black and Latinx and other people of color in key leadership positions in health, healthcare, health insurance, various health entities. There's a broad spectrum. Kevin Churchwell, president, CEO at Children's Hospital,
right.
myself leading Mass League Community Hospitals, Tom Sequist and Elsie Tavares at MGB, Manny Lopes, good friend from East Boston Health Center, who's ascending into a leadership role at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And the list is long, whether it's Harvard School of Public Health, Kizmikia Corbett, who's the young woman, African-American woman who found a cure for the treatment, the vaccine with Moderna. She's here in Boston now working out of Harvard School of Public Health. We're all coming together to say, to make sure that this is not a moment and a movement. Then you have separately, everybody in their individual spaces are trying to figure out what our responsibility is to deliver on health equity. So to your point, Jim, I'm hoping that this is a movement and not a moment. And I'm feeling optimistic because people with lived experiences are in key places to move this together, move this forward, like folks did in Chapter 58, health reform in Massachusetts, and every iteration of health reform since 2006.
But your position, with which I am in total agreement, and I'm sure Marjorie is too, to get the health equity, you need equity in lots of surrounding ways that affect your health. And those healthcare leaders, while they have loud voices and important voices, and determine to a great degree what happens within the healthcare system, don't determine what happens in terms of your housing, your schooling, your whatever else that does affect you, the public safety in your community. How's that part going, that sort of broader vision of what leads to that health equity promised land?
Well, I think what's happening in this effort of people of experience, of lived experiences, Black and brown who are in these roles, is we're asking our elected officials to step up and deliver on the next iteration of health reform, which would be a health equity proposal, right? We call them omnibus bills, Jim, as both you and Marjorie know. They're basically jam-packed with a whole bunch of policy stuff. There are some things that are direct, there's some things that are tangential, more arms, you know, more of a distance from the main topic, but they're all intended to have some significant impact on an issue. That's health equity. We know that food insecurity matters. We know that housing insecurity matters. We know that bad education and bad failing school systems contribute to bad health outcomes. We know that food deserts is a problem. We know that trauma and internalized racism and racism generally leads to some of the conditions that we're dealing with in our communities, like substance use disorder, mass caps, like trauma, like drive-by shootings and internal violence in communities. We have to connect all these dots for the first time that I've ever seen, and then have a strategy going forward that will make sure that our Black, brown, poor, immigrant, rural folks across the Commonwealth can live as long a lives and build wealth and do all the great things that all of us want to do.
We're talking to Michael Curry, President and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. You know, we've been badgering you a lot about vaccine mandates. I know you're not keen on them still. But, you know, now we're seeing, you know, the state police, everybody's going to resign. Turned out that didn't happen. Cops, firefighters, there's still some resistance there. But it seems as though, for the most part, when people are required to get vaccinated, they don't quit their job. They get vaccinated. So have you changed at all? Are you still a little bit reluctant?
Well, I've never been against vaccine mandates, but I'm cautious about them. And again, you've heard me make the comparison to the Clinton crime bill. We know we had crime.
Right.
We know that we had, you know, violence. We knew that we had addiction. But we now know many years later that the strategy we used to address that was not the right strategy. Three strikes, mandatory minimums, lock them up, throw away the key. That was never the right strategy. I'm just cautioning us to, in the moment of COVID-19, where we say, hey, get rid of those folks who are hesitant, eliminate their livelihoods, because I want people to understand it. You're talking about letting that doctor, that Black doctor, that white doctor, that Hispanic, Latinx nurse, letting them go and eliminating them or removing them from their livelihood because we've not gotten them the information that they need, or they just, for their own reasons, religious or otherwise, have decided that they don't want to get a vaccine. I think we have work to do. And I think the reality is we're at a critical point. Let's do it the right way. Just like we shouldn't have just locked them up. We should have got them services. Let's find out, because there are many, Marjorie, to counter that point you made, many people are losing their jobs, and many more will lose their job as we implement these federal mandates. We should be trying to make sure they were. I remind people, these were sheroes and heroes just a minute ago, right? Before we even had vaccines. These are the same people who showed up at work, risked their lives, risked their families' lives, and were sheroes and heroes. Shame on us if we don't have an empathy to support them as well.
Talking to Michael Curry. Michael, did you happen to hear Philip Martin, our colleague's piece, where he interviewed five Black people who had lived in Boston, who had decided to move and stay in Atlanta for a variety of reasons?
I did, and it was moving for me. So I'll tell you right now, I'm in Times Square.
You are?
Here for a meeting. Yep. Oh. I'm in Times Square, staying at, I won't tell you where I'm staying, because you'll be jealous if I tell you the hotel.
Okay, wait a second. Don't even think about trying that move. Where are you staying?
Privacy there, Jim.
I'm staying at Margaritaville, which is right in Times Square.
Oh gosh.
And I had a series of meetings here. That being said, you know, as a person who grew up in Roxbury, you know, I could tell you I loved and hated Boston. It was a tale of two cities. I hated shopping downtown because I didn't feel it was a place that was welcoming for me. If you go into a restaurant, a bar, you get treated, whether it's those little microaggressions that people give you, because they're not used to mass numbers or many Black and brown folks. Every time I went to eat, whether it's Copley, Cleveland Circle, Coolidge Corner, people thought I was from somewhere else. And I'm from Boston, born and raised in this city. So we have a challenge in Boston where there's a tale of two cities. Black and brown folks cannot rent clubs or rent establishments because we're thought of as gangbangers and drug addicts and we'll start violence. This is a long story. We need to know our own hallway reputation as a city, and we don't know it. Once we know we have a hallway reputation that is poor, Michael Che and many others have echoed that across the country. We're not where we were, but it's still not a city on a hill that welcomes all people of color.
You know what I found interesting, at least I had both Philip and Chip Greenidge, who I'm sure you know, and I feel really bad I hadn't met before, and I'm going to get, he is one impressive character who's spending half of his life here still and half in Atlanta. But more than one of the people who were interviewed by Philip, who went to Atlanta to do some of this, said the election of a person of color who was not Black, Michelle Wu, wasn't enough for them, didn't address all the disparities that they, and the lack of feeling welcome that you were describing a minute ago. What's your reaction to that reaction?
Well, I know Chip very well, and Chip started his conversation almost two decades ago with what he called State of Young Black Boston, where we got together. I was 20 years younger and was in these rooms having this exact same conversation. It's unfortunate it took others to have an epiphany 20 years later to have these same conversations, but he had them. That being said, yes, that just like when Obama was elected and we thought we were post-racial, or even here in Massachusetts when DeVos was elected and we thought we were post-racial, we weren't post-racial. Systemic racism is embedded in how we treat each other, what we think of each other, our systems and our hiring, promotion, who we rent to, what contracts we give. As a result, some people say, I'm not coming back to that city just because Michelle Wu is mayor or Kim Janey was interim mayor. I now need to see the change that is actually systemic, that is writ large throughout the society in Boston, and then I'll consider coming back. But right now, as I talk about New York, I can go right down the street to Harlem and I can bask in culture, music, art, intellectual conversations. I can go to Atlanta and feel that same vibe. Boston has strangled that out of the city. And thanks for Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen, and a good friend of mine, Nia, and those folks and others built some pockets of culture, but we've strangled that out of the city.
You know, it always seemed to me that Boston was, and I'm not a world traveler, but I lived in California for a while, and I noticed how when I went to California, although there was terrible prejudice against Chicanos, it was different in the sense that in Boston, it's always seemed to me it was kind of people were obsessed with WASPs, and then they were obsessed with the Irish, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, I should say, then the Irish. There was a lot of talk about anti-Semitism in Boston, which you don't see as much elsewhere, like a total pecking order. You know, Protestants, the Irish Catholics, Jewish people, black people. I mean, we are kind of wrapped up in this stuff, it seems to me, in a way that other places aren't. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I also defend Boston, right? Because I travel a lot. So I'm in Chicago, New York, L.A., Minneapolis, St. Paul. You know, racism is rampant and is, you know, writ large across the country. It just looks different. And Boston, to its credit, is a melting pot. So you, as we saw with busing, you put a lot of poor white, black, brown people in the same pot. And all of a sudden, even they, as are many our Irish brothers and sisters who experienced systemic racism as they came into this country, or ethnic racism, came into this country and were treated differently. Irish need not apply in the city of Boston. And then went forward and many perpetuated those same stereotypes. We don't want them in our schools.
Yeah.
We don't want them in our neighborhoods. So the reality is we have a lot to learn about our shared lived histories across this globe. And a threat to justice or equity anywhere is a threat to justice and equity everywhere. So we should be looking across our population and figuring out how do we finally wipe out the taint of race in our many systems. And I think there's a potential there, Marjorie, for us to get there. But I need all these other ethnic groups to dig into their own history and then bring that forward and to operate with that in mind.
Now, before you go, I do want to apologize that I didn't participate in the conversation for the last 2 minutes because I have been researching Margaritaville Resort in Times Square in New York City. And we want to know if you have eaten at the Margaritaville Restaurant, the Landshark Bar and Grill, the 5 O'Clock Somewhere Bar, or the License to Chill Bar. How many of those have you been in, Michael Curry?
Well, I will tell you, I'm standing here right now with barbecue sauce on my face because I had to guzzle it. I had to swallow it down quickly to jump on this interview with you. So
you are
the Margaritaville Restaurant.
Hold on. I just want to know. I would assume that the margaritas there are the best you've ever had. Is that true, too? I mean, we'd be disappointed if that weren't true.
Well, I'm here for business, so I can't drink.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure you are. Okay.
Michael Curry, thanks for your candor.
Oh, my God.
It's good to talk to you. I know. I've been checking it out, too, Marjorie.
God.
You're a little late to the
Michael
fair.
Michael Curry, I'm looking at this now. Tropical in Times Square with all the glass windows.
Well, he has
and
no
the
time
plants.
For that because he's just doing work.
Yeah.
So, Michael Curry, it's good to talk to you. We'll talk to you again soon. Good luck in your trip.
Good. Take care.
Thank you very much. Margaritaville.
You know what I'm embarrassed to say? I never even heard. Nor do I.
Neither did I.
It's apparently the hottest hotel.
Would you look at the pictures?
Believe me, I've been looking at the pictures, looking at the menus.
Here I was.
Look at the drink menu, and you're having a conversation, and I was drifting off.
We thank very much Michael Curry. He's the president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and member of Governor Baker's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group. He's staying at Margaritaville there down in Times Square. He's also a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, where he chairs the board's Advocacy and Policy Committee. I want to mention once again, after a too long hiatus, Jim and I are going to be back live tomorrow from 11 to 2 at the Boston Public Library in Copley Square.
From
the neighborhood drop by. Everybody, I think, has to be wearing masks.
Always
drop by.
I mean, you're eating or drinking from the Newsfeed Cafe. You
right.
can take them off. But beyond that, yes.
Coming up, the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price are here to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. They are next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Are white women to blame for the dismantling of our democracy? In Renee Graham's latest column for The Globe, she writes that when white women vote Republican, as they did in Virginia's governor's race, they're voting against their own interests for things like paid family leave, reproductive rights. Reverend Irene Monroe and Amit Price will join us to discuss that and more. Reverend Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist and the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Reverend Price is a founding pastor of Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston and the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. They both, of course, host the All Revved Up podcast here at GBH. Welcome, Irene. Welcome, Amit.
Hey, thanks for having
us back.
Happy
Monday.
And to you.
Hey, great to talk to you both. As the white woman in the room, I would like to say it is all my fault. We'll get to that in just a second.
Most people think it's actually all my fault, but despite, go ahead.
But in any case, Jim. I was fascinated by this story. I'm fascinated in general by people who are willing to lose their jobs as opposed to get vaccinated because, lots of us, you don't want to lose your job, right? But this story about this nurse of all people at Mass General Brigham who worked in the COVID intensive care unit and saw the suffering people went through, she's losing her job because she won't get vaccinated. But what she said was, you do really well as a nurse at Mass General Brigham Women's too. She said, I'm Christian. I've always believed I have a choice to put in my body what I want. There were no vaccine issues, in Christ's time, Emmett. So what's she talking about?
Well, this is an interesting challenge because a number of folks, particularly in the story, were what we call new believers. They're new to the faith.
Yeah.
And really don't have the long-term mature perspective on what thus the Bible really says. Many folks have found themselves in a challenging situation, found a faith leader or found a faith community that spoke to their needs and their concerns immediately, and then use that kind of to permeate, a kind of life, mission, as it were, in terms of ethics and morals and values. Here, Christianity has nothing to do with the vaccine, other than the fact that she is right, that she has a very important choice in terms of what she puts in her body, the same way that her organization and her former employer has a very important choice who they decide to employ. And so Christianity does not privilege you that your choice is more important than everyone else's choice. And thus invoking your belief as a Christian means that you're more important and your decision making is more important than other people's decision making.
Yeah.
All right. Irene, you
the
buy
identity.
That?
No, not at all. Not at all. No.
What a surprise. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I disagree with the whole idea. I think it's a smokescreen when you say stuff she's new to the faith or not matured, because I know I speak to a lot of mature folks who are also, anti-vaxxers here. So let me tell you what I've been doing.
Oh, well, wait a second. Do you buy what Emmett said? You meant you don't buy what the woman said.
I don't buy what Emmett or the woman said.
Okay.
Okay. I'm saying both here and stuff. So I want to share with you what I've been doing on the down low here. So, I'm in conversation with Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett that you have on the show.
Oh, she's great.
And she's fabulous. And she's going in the right direction. She wrote this article, it was last month, I think, called Knocking on Another's Door. And the thesis of that article is that religious and medical leaders must, do more to engage folks in this dialogue around COVID-19. And one of the things is, and I think that in getting religious leaders in there, that's one way, but you're still missing folks. Because one of the things that I pointed out to Dr. Gergen-Barnett is that, see, when you go to those big churches or the ministers, you're not really getting the folks that are mostly out of the church or in different types of churches, like your storefront churches, the ones that that you read about in Go Tell It on the Mountain, James Baldwin's novel here. So one of the things here that I think that that could have happened with this woman, since she is new in the faith, I think that the conversation should have been, and this is not for HR to do, but we need to have, just as we have politicians come to church to get their votes, we got to begin to get doctors to come to church services. And some of them do go to church too. I need to say that too, so there's not that demarcation. But we we actually need doctors to come in and go to these churches and say, because it'll do two things. It will get people to trust them. It also get folks who will say, well, maybe I should go and get this check. I mean, they can't just come in and talk about COVID. I mean, if you're talking about the black community, you need to talk about hypertension, obesity, and all other sorts of stuff. But I think that we need to begin to have doctors on a regular basis come to these communities and more importantly, go to these storefront churches. We know the big ministers in our community, but we don't know those Pentecostal storefront churches. And I just need to say this here. I do notice this here that the anti-vax is a challenge among men, and that's across whether class, educational levels here. This is what one brother said to me. He said, it's real easy to get a COVID shot, but it's quite costly to get a COVID test. So there lies the kind of suspicion. And I'll tell you another thing, a relationship that Thea had to break up with her barber. She had a serious hair boo-boo. I sent Emmett the picture. It looked like someone plowed through her head. I mean, it was so bad that people would just at first gasp and then laugh.
But
Am I telling you the truth?
You telling the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd go like, oh, and then you go, Dr. James. And then she tells you what happened. But she had a hair boo-boo because she was doing her hair. She thought she'd go back into her, you know, it would be good to get back in the chair. And what she found out was that, no, he did not believe in the vaccine. And so there's something problematic. Like, so we need them to come to the barbershop where black men hang out. You know, bring a brother up in there, a black, you know, doctor. So we got to figure out how do we get these doctors in places where people are highly suspicious of the vaccine.
We're talking to Emmett Price and Irene Monroe.
Okay, so let's get back to how white women are ruining the world. This is a Renee Graham column, and she talks about how when white women vote for Republicans, they generally are sustaining white supremacy. What'd you make of her thesis, Emmett?
You know, I think Renee Graham is one of the most brilliant, you know, columnists that we have, not only in Boston or, you know, Massachusetts, but actually in the country. Here, I'm still processing what she's saying, because I think her general thesis is that, you know, white women vote for the woman, I mean, the whiteness piece versus the woman piece. And thus, in voting for the whiteness, they're actually voting against the woman piece. And so I'm still processing that. But I think, you know, I think there's something to it, because if you think about Black Lives Matter, if you think about some of the social movements that we've had, including especially Me Too, it's been white women at the forefront. And yet their voting goes against the very ethic of what they're protesting against. And so I think we have to really wrestle with that.
By the way, just to give you a couple of numbers, Irene, before you speak, only according to Renee, only 31% of white women in Georgia voted for now Senator Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff. 63% of white women voted for a man, I would argue, is a credibly accused sexual predator, if I remember correctly, of teens, Roy Moore, in the Alabama race down there. So she gives pretty hard evidence that black women have come to the rescue of a Democratic Party that always hasn't always come to the rescue of them, and white women are enabling these Republicans who vote against the self-interest of white women. But go ahead, Irene.
Well, listen, you know, so I guess our audience know this, that I'm not a white woman, so I don't want to speak for all white women here. Okay?
Feel free.
But
it's okay.
I do want to say a couple of things here when we talk about Jane Crow. Jane Crow is not just in the South, but she's up South here. She's in Wellesley. She's in Cambridge. I mean, she's all over the country here. One of the things immediately reading this article was two things. Do I buy the thesis? Because the problem to me with the thesis, and I love Renee. We love Renee. I mean, we really love Renee, Emmett and I do.
She's very good.
But I think that you're asking, which you know, it's sort of like when people ask me, are you more oppressed being black or being a woman? And I think it's far more nuanced than that. I immediately after reading the article, I wanted to think. I thought about, well, how would Beth Moore have voted on this issue here. And so, and I was trying to think, because I see her as a feminist, you know, I see her, you know, embracing a lot of what we would call those liberal issues here. And so I decided to take a walk in my neighborhood, and in my neighborhood, I happened to run across my lovely neighbor, Risa Medic. She was working in her garden, and I said, Risa, I got this problem here, and I didn't want you to speak for all white women, but can you help me with this problem? And so we had this conversation for about 20 minutes, and she said something I thought was interesting. Let me tell you what we walked away with. We walked away that both black and white mothers have to have the conversation about the talk, and it'll be differently. But this is what she shared with me then. She says that just like all mothers, they do the lion's share of the rearing. And she says that just as black mothers, pretty much like black mothers and black and fathers are in this conversation too, that difficulty about race, how do you talk about race and not dampen and damage the child's, you know, hope and view of the world? How do you have this conversation? I think that what we need to do is how to help white mothers have that conversation too, and not feel like they're being traitors to their race. I think that's very, very, very important. I thought what was also important that when we look at Obama, that sweet moment when white women were voting for him, to know that a large number of white women did not vote for him, but did vote for Clinton and LBJ. And I thought, well, the simple reason is that they were Southerners. They can identify with these guys, and they're not part of what is called the coastal elite. Yeah, they're not part of the coastal elite, and also they come from what we call those flyover counties. So I think that it's much more nuanced than just giving us those blatant numbers here. But I think that if we can help mothers, because mothers do the education too, help them have this conversation about it, then we don't have this kind of craziness we saw in the Virginia race about I'm against critical race theory that is only taught in law schools.
We're talking to Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. You know, almost, I would say, maybe no more than a couple of weeks goes by that I am embarrassed, and Marjorie has occasionally admitted her embarrassment as well, to learn about a major figure in American history, a black American, about whom I knew nothing. And I'm embarrassed that there's another person to add to the list, Claudette Colvin. Who of the two of you want to tell us a little bit about this woman who made history in this country? Emmett, go ahead.
Yeah. Claudette Colvin was Rosa Parks before Rosa Parks, right?
Exactly. I mean,
she was 15 years old, and she was arrested in Montgomery, Alabama for not getting up off the bus. And she was actually sitting in the black section of the bus, but the white section ran out of seats. And so the bus driver tried to give up that first row of the black section. And whereas Rosa Parks was a little older, a little bit more, quote unquote, dignified, and as Irene would say, a little lighter skinned, Claudette Colvin was a little feisty little sister. And, you know, she made up her mind that she was not getting up that day, even as her friends tried to, you know, cajole her to get up. And so she was arrested. And here she is at 82 years old with a probation record on record. And they have not been able to get that removed from her from all of these years, going back to March 1955. Yeah. So here we talk about systemic injustice.
You know, before you comment on her, Irene, I want to do two things. One, I want to hear her voice. Here's a little bit of the 82-year-old Claudette Colvin speaking to an audience last week after lawyers filed a request to have that record cleared. Here she is.
I'm honored to, you know, like I'm saying, I'm 82 years old. And what it means that I guess you can say that now I'm no longer a juvenile delinquent.
That's a good, great line. You know what's also amazing? The lawyer representing her in front of the court to have her record cleared is the same lawyer who represented her more than a half century ago in the original proceedings. But Irene, you want to add a couple of thoughts here?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the things is that doesn't get addressed in the when we look at the civil rights movement. We don't look at it in according to skin color, the colorism in the movement, the sexism. We certainly understand, and we don't look at it in terms of the class divisions that were very much, you know, operative within the movement. So yeah, I mean, one of the things you know, we talk about white supremacy, and one of the things I say about white supremacy is an ideology. It's just not the province of black people. But again, the way in which we keep our eyes shaped by a white gaze is the way in which colorism played very much in the civil rights movement. So here's Rosa Parks. She's what Beyonce would say, Becky with the good hair and the light skin was a much better, you know, optic and prettier optic than a 15-year-old pregnant girl that people were wondering, yeah, is the baby this brother or is it from this white guy? Because, you know, she was seeing both, and God forbid if it was this, you know, this white guy that she was having a relationship with. So the optics didn't look good. It's similarly the way in which we choose our icon. It's like with Matthew Shepard. We use Matthew Shepard because he's a white angelic, as they say, looking guy. But, you know, there were many more Matthew Shepards before Matthew Shepards. And then we put a story around him that, you know, that that it's anti, you know, homophobia, where it might have also been that, as well as that it was a mess deal that went bad. So, I mean, we got to look back now enough time to really give, you know, Claudette her rightful due in American history, and particularly in this iconic history of the civil rights movement. So I'm hoping that it will come to fruition. What I wanted to ask you and Marjorie is that have you folks, because you're liberal, have your folks had the talk with your kids?
Are you talking about the talk about race? I wasn't sure what you were talking about.
That's right.
When kids ask you about black kids, when you're talking about black kids or racism,
It's sort of like what we have to do in terms of telling kids, black kids, without dashing their hopes and scaring them about just how the world perceives you and how walking in the world might be problematic for you at a certain time in your life. And we like to hit it before it hits. We like to hit it with them before the incident hits them. And I was just saying, like, you know, your liberal folks, have you had that kind of talk with your kids? I know your kids are grown.
Well, I think I certainly talked about with my kids, you know, that if black kids get mistreated, and I mean, they saw it in the schools, you know, they saw what happened.
No, but it's not about black kids. It's about you explaining whiteness to them, explaining, look, this is what society has set up. And this is, you know, it's like having to talk about how we have unknowingly or knowingly continued the kind of race relationships in the world.
Well, you know, while Marjorie's thinking of this, I should say my kids are not white. My kids are Chinese American. And I have to say, I'm thinking while Marjorie was answering, I would say they probably brought it up first with us because they're probably more sensitive to it. They're not black, obviously, but they've experienced discrimination as well. So frankly, I'm embarrassed to say I think the conversation may have started on their end rather than ours.
Well, that was probably true with me when they saw something happen in school to black kids. But yeah, I mean, you know something, Irene? I'm thinking about 25 years ago. Was I thinking about these things as much as I should have? Probably not until my children said something about, which they did because they saw it, tragically, a lot of mistreatment of black kids and really racism against black kids in school situations and in Brooklyn. I'm not saying necessarily in the schools, but outside of the schools. But I think you all have to have the talk when you're white about racism in the world, don't you? In kind of a general sense, I guess everybody does, don't they?
Yeah, but I'm talking about having the talk. Like I have the talk with kids about what it is to be black in the world. I'm saying, do you have the talk about what it's like to be white in the world and what comes with that?
Well, I think that was the answer, but that was the answer to the question. I mean, the answer is yes. Part of that discussion that Marjorie and I were both describing, which I think trickled up in both of our cases rather than came from above, from the parents, was part of that, but you know, not as intentionally as you would like it to be perfectly conscious.
Not
but
that
I think
I like
but I don't mean that critically of you. I mean that observationally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You view, and I totally agree with you. It's an important part of raising a kid who is not black in this country. And I like to think that if it were happening now or in the last 10 years, my kids are in their late 20s. Marjorie's got a couple of late 20s and a 30. It might be different. But can I get back to Claudette just for one second here?
Oh, sure.
And I may regret this question of both of you. Have both of you known about Claudette Colvin for your lives as soon as you started learning about American history?
I met her. Yeah. I met her. I passed the church in Soundview section of the Bronx.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So it's
Oh, she
so
lived in the Bronx for a while. I forgot about
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. That's how about came you? Straight to the Bronx. Yeah.
How
so
about you,
very,
Emmett?
Very hard not to know her.
How about you?
Yeah,
Emmett?
Yeah, yeah. I learned about her probably when I was a teenager. You know, one of the things that happened in my household is my parents had us do some supplemental history. In terms of Black history that was not being taught in the school.
And
we read about Claudette Colvin, you know, during that time, you know. So I didn't know of her, absolutely.
So what are you doing on the podcast?
Yeah, we're
two?
Out of time. This is what I wanted to talk about.
Oh, sorry.
Why did I get married, which is what millions of Americans ask themselves sometimes every single solitary day. But we don't have time, so that's what it's called, right?
Give us 30 seconds.
Just Irene comes up with some foolishness called term limits in marriage, so go listen.
That's right. Right.
Okay.
Yes. You know why? Because a lot of people stay in their relationship for the kids. And when that last kid goes off to college, they go. And all
just
I'm
let them listen,
is
Irene.
Need,
let them listen.
Yeah, well, they need. Okay. Well, it needs term limits. Okay. Everything needs term limits.
Got
all
it.
Right. Well, we'll listen to that because, like I said, I think you've hit on something that is a cultural nerve for millions of people. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll talk about it next week. The Reverend Ira Munroe and Emmett Price will join us every week. The Reverend Ira Munroe is a syndicated religion columnist in the Boston Voice of Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Emmett G. Price III is founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Austin and the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Together, they host the All Revved Up podcast. Okay, coming up, will Democrats finally deliver on their promise for immigration reform? Our immigration man, Ali Narani, is here to discuss. He's next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Democrats have been promising immigration reform for years. They are making a long-shot effort to include it, whittled-down version, in a social spending bill that is massive. Join us online to discuss the likelihood we'll see promises kept, or at least some, is Ali Rani. Ali's president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, the Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Ali, good to talk to you.
Great talking to you all. How are you?
Good.
Hey, great to talk to you, Ali. Let's start with this, your newsletter that you just posted about the anger about immigration and our supposed losing of our culture from both Republicans and Democrats. Tell us what you said.
Yeah, so, you know, over the last week, I would say a few different things have really kind of come together. One, and I would say probably most importantly, is that the immigration movement, driven by just incredibly courageous folks who are directly impacted by our broken immigration system, have really increased the pressure on House Democrats and even Senate Democrats in the White House to include immigration provisions in reconciliation. And that anger, which I traced back really to 2010 and a massive march that we played a role in helping convene, has been growing, I would say, for more than a decade. And that anger is now being directed at Democrats to make good on a promise to fix the immigration system, or at least parts of it, through reconciliation. On the other hand, last week, when you look at Virginia, but also just more broadly at polling that is coming out from Republican circles, is that the Republican or conservative base is also extremely angry about immigration, but obviously for very, very different reasons. So the case that I made in this newsletter that you can find at alinarani.org is that there's this cycle of anger where the anger from the immigrant community is kind of feeds into the anger coming from the conservative base. And it's really hard to establish any sort of trust that ultimately brings the country together around immigration solutions. And, you know, that is getting to those solutions is not going to happen overnight. And we've got to figure out ways to chip at it.
By the way, Youngkin didn't talk about immigration at all, much to my surprise, at least. I'm right about that, aren't I? The victim,
that's what
Virginia?
I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I found over the weekend as well. But then over the weekend, the National Republican Congressional Committee, in essence, the committee that organizes the congressional races for the GOP, they released an immigration messaging memo that more or less triples down on really, really tough and harsh anti-immigrant language. So I think the Youngkin case is an outlier when you have Trump as well as Leader McCarthy on the Republican House side and others saying, you know what, we see being anti-immigrant as a path to victory.
But you mentioned in your piece this whole idea of while the Republicans are much more worried about losing their culture and identity than ever, apparently, a third of Democrats are worried about the same thing. So what are they talking about? People speaking different languages at the supermarket, or what are
people
they
have different color skin than they
yeah.
do?
Yeah. What is this?
So this is the other thing that happened last week is that Brookings Institution and the Public Religion Research Institute released their 2021 American Value Survey. And every year it is, I mean, hands down, one of the most useful pieces of data that comes out. And Bill Galston, who works at Brookings, he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal where he lifts out this data that shows that, you know, yes, Republicans are worried about culture change, but so are Democrats. And the Democratic worry is not anywhere near as intense as what it is on the Republican side. But what it showed me, at least, is that, yes, the country is changing. And these changes are having an impact on the way that people see themselves, much less the country. And we have to figure out a way that people can internalize those changes in a way that doesn't lead them into this path of extremism and nativism that we really see bubbling on the Republican side. But ultimately, people are worried about, yes, different languages, different cultures, different religions, and none of this is new. I mean, we go through this process as a nation all the time. What I'm worried about is, do we have the institutional, much less the political leadership that can help us figure our way out this time?
But when you say that, it's kind of people mm-hmm. are concerned that their school is going to be overrun by immigrants from a different country, and now they're worried about the Afghan immigrants coming here, or is it?
I think it's more amorphous than yours. I don't think people are concretely sitting down at the kitchen table and saying, you know, those people sleeping under the bridge from Haiti,
right?
They're going to be in our schools next week. It's this general,
but I do think
fear
but I do think in certain places where there is, like to say Lawrence, which is a heavily immigrant community, I think there is a certain amount of fear that if a lot new immigrants come to your country, what's going to happen to your kid's classroom? Is it going to go from 20 kids to 40 kids? Is everybody going to be speaking a different
language? I would argue there probably isn't a lot of fear in Lawrence because it's a really diverse community. I don't know that you're right about that. Do you?
I know growing up in an immigrant community, it was a big concern. Yeah. But go ahead. What do you think?
So a lot of times, according to the data, and we also see this through experience, is that the greatest fears are coming from the communities that are changing the least. In 2017,
really?
it, especially these days, kind of because of the way we all kind of bring it, you know, we all take in media or news. And in 2017, Eric Kaufman, who's a researcher from Oxford University in the UK, he wrote this amazing book called White Shift. And what he found through both his original data and also other data sets is that people's perception of migration at a national level or a global level outweighs or has greater influence than their experience of around immigration at a local level. And what that means is that, you know, if you live in Worcester and you live next door to a Latino family, you probably get to know that family, you get to respect them, be friends with them, share a barbecue with them, etc. But you're still worried about and have concerns about immigration in kind of a national or even in a global context, because you don't feel like there's control. So all of these things kind of mash together and lead people to say, you know what, the country's changing, I'm not sure if somebody has control over it, I'm scared. And I think from our perspective as the National Immigration Forum, we get in trouble when we don't listen to those fears or respect those fears. We have our greatest success when we sit down and say, okay, what are you worried about? And then how do we have a conversation about those fears?
So that means you're right, Jim. There's more concern in Lincoln than in Lawrence.
Well, you know, in all seriousness, by the way, I can't believe you even asked the question. With all due respect, what was the biggest issue in Jersey? Critical race theory, which isn't taught in any of the schools. So it's like you asking Ali, what about critical race theory mattered to the voters for Glenn Youngkin? The answer is nothing, because there isn't any.
Yeah, but
it was brilliantly marketed.
But it was a code word for something underneath
exactly.
that, which is talking about things differently.
And the code word for this is they don't look like me.
Yeah.
That's in my estimation. You know, you mentioned in passing, Ali, what's going on or not going on in Congress. We've discussed this with you forever. This pathway to citizenship for a limited number of people, including Dreamers and certain workers, which we discussed with you a year ago, which was the original intention of the Democrats, obviously killed by the unelected parliamentarian who says it doesn't fit into the budgetary bills. Now the Democrats in the House are trying to come back with what at least seems to me, maybe you can describe it, sort of a more temporary reprieve for pretty much the same subsets of people, I think, dreamers and certain workers in certain industries. One, am I accurately describing it? And two, do the Democrats, if the parliamentarian says yet again that it doesn't fit within the parameters of what a budget bill should be, meaning for the Build Back Better bill, so to speak, are the Democrats ready to just overrule the parliamentarian and do it anyway?
So the House reconciliation package that passed on Friday evening included two major immigration provisions. The first is humanitarian parole. And like you said, Jim, this is a temporary legal status that in this case would be renewable for 2 5-year periods to those who are undocumented, who arrived before 2011. And there's some parameters on what are the, in terms of specific criteria for people to apply beyond date. The second major provision is that the bill included the recapture of unused green cards. And this is a pretty significant move as well.
What does that mean?
It means that every year we issue as a nation, roughly speaking, I want to say about 500,000 green cards, more or less. If those green cards are not used because of bureaucratic delays or processing delays, those green cards disappear, poof, gone. Uh-huh. Which means that every year, particularly after COVID and the Trump administration, tens of thousands of green cards just disappear. And that then exacerbates the backlog of those who are looking to apply for green cards, which disproportionately impacts immigrants from India and China who are subject to kind of per country caps on green cards. So what this language would do is say, okay, we're going to recapture unused green cards going back a period of time, and in essence, use those unused green cards to ease the green card backlog, which is a huge boon for folks who have been stuck in a very antiquated process, to put it kindly.
So, but is that likely to pass, get the approval of this unknown, unelected parliamentarian?
You know, Jim, I feel like you have some opinions about the parliamentarian.
Well, you know why I say this, by the way, and I know you're joking. You know why I say this? Do you think Mitch McConnell would say, oh, we want to do X, but we can't do it because the unelected parliamentarian said we can't do it? He would probably have him or her deported, even if they're an American citizen. The notion that the Democrats want to do, and this is only half a loaf, as you know much better than we do, the notion that they might be stopped by this sort of rule is unbelievable to me. Well, let me ask another question, because who knows what the parliamentarian is going to do.
Right.
Is this sort of half a loaf thing, as I'm describing it, as you filled in the blanks, is it likely to get 50 Democrats to support in the Senate or no?
I think if the parliamentarian signs off on it, I think that it's a pretty good chance. I mean, Sinema has a history of being good on immigration issues. Manchin, Manchin wants to see some elements of border security included in the reconciliation package if other immigration provisions are included. You go back to the original Bernie Sanders proposal on budget reconciliation. Mm-hmm. It included billions of dollars for border security.
You support that, don't you? You think strategically that's the right way to go, don't you?
Strategically and kind of from a policy perspective, we do need to secure ports of entry and strengthen the border processing and security systems. So I think if, again, parliamentarian signs off and they include some border security provisions, I do think you'd get to 51 votes in the Senate.
So Ali Narani, our immigration expert, there's been a big controversy over compensating families who were separated from their children at the United States-Mexico border under President Trump. Here, we're going to play some sound from Biden last Wednesday, responding to a question about this from a Fox News reporter. And then we're going to hear what White House senior advisor Cedric Richmond had to say about the exchange on Fox News yesterday.
Your administration is planning to pay illegal immigrants who are separated from their families at the border up to $450,000 each, possibly $1 million per family.
But it's not true.
So this is a garbage report.
Yeah.
Okay.
$450,000 per person. Is that what you're saying?
That was separated from a family member at the border under the last administration.
That's not going to happen.
The question was from a Fox reporter asking about whether compensation for being separated and losing a child would be an incentive to come to America. The question is so insensitive, disrespectful, that that's what he was commenting to.
And by the way, Richmond went on to say that's the Department of Justice is going to deal with that, trying to create distance between the White House and Biden.
But there's
and the issue.
There's a lawsuit about this. We are talking about money for people who lost children at the border, and there are hundreds of children who have yet to be reunited with their families. So what's the deal, Ali?
So ACLU back in 2019 filed a class action lawsuit. Department of Justice is currently, as now we all know, is in negotiations potentially to settle that lawsuit. So what the president said last week, he seems to have revised and refined over the weekend. I saw clips this morning that on Saturday, Biden said that families should be eligible for some amount of remuneration or compensation. He didn't put a dollar figure on it, as far as I recall, but I think there are a couple of things that are happening. One, yes, the White House is trying to separate itself from a Department of Justice decision. But the other piece of this is that if DOJ and the ACLU cannot reach a settlement, it's pretty likely the ACLU will then just turn to the courts and then see what they can get the families through the court system. So, last week it was McConnell and Senator Grassley sent a letter to the Attorney General asking, what's going on with this? So this is clearly a story and an issue that's going to continue to bubble. And frankly, Republicans are going to try to, use this to erase any memory of the fact that President Trump separated well over 5,000 parents from their children in order to, try to scare people from trying to seek protection in the United States.
You know, in a perfect world, which this has not been for a pretty long time, there is no question that these families suffered, in my opinion, about as horrible thing as you can possibly imagine, thanks to the sadism, the cruelty of Donald Trump and his minions. Having said that, we talked to E.J. Dion from The Washington Post this morning and talked about how the McAuliffe slip when he said, parents shouldn't have any decision making about their kids' education is going to be used throughout this campaign. If there is significant payment,
oh my God,
even though it's merited,
yeah,
they're going to be it is going to be a landslide. And it seems to me strategically, Ali, what I would do if I was the head of the Democratic Party or Merrick Garland is try to stall the negotiations as long as possible. And if you had to stall them even further, tell the ACLU you got to go to trial and settle the cases after November of next year so that the Republicans can't seize on a, let's say, $150,000 figure per person, even when people can't afford to pay for their gas. Is that crass on my part or is that strategically wise?
Our take on this is that the Biden administration should do two things. Number one is to ensure from a policy perspective that this never happens again. That
separation
never again.
Of course.
Right? Number two, for the families that have been separated and are reunified, that they are offered right now, they're offered 2 or 3 years of humanitarian parole. The Biden administration should say, you can come in on humanitarian parole. You meet certain criteria. You can get on a path to legal permanent residence and United States citizenship.
That's great.
Those two things are within the power of the Biden administration.
That's good.
And then number three, the ACLU should pursue compensation for the families. But I think that this should be turned over to the judicial branch and let the courts decide, okay, what is the right thing to do here?
I wonder what the strategy, the smart money says, was the strategy of the ACLU here.
What strategy?
I mean,
their strategy is these people were totally screwed and they deserve some compensation.
I know, but they do think politically as well,
I don't know about that.
Well, that's why I'm asking Ali.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think this goes back a little bit to what I was saying earlier, where there is a completely legitimate level of anger coming from the immigrant community based on not just 10 plus, 20 plus years of inaction by Congress, but then the actions of the Trump administration. So that anger is being reflected, I think rightfully so, by organizations like the ACLU and others. And they, in essence, have created a very strong and powerful left flank. But at the end of the day, some sort of a solution needs to be worked out that addresses not just the issues and the tragedies that these families have faced, but also what the broad American public would like to see from elected officials.
You know, I feel foolish even saying this to you. We are such frauds, the American people. Is like everybody who is railing against any of these policies are the people who go buy stuff that is totally dependent upon it being affordable, that there are lower income migrant workers, many of whom are undocumented, willing to do this. And you and I forgot, I'm so sorry.
What?
Ali, I'm sure you read this, and I didn't give it to Marjorie, and she may not have seen it, which should have been on today's agenda. We'll do it next time. Do you see the story in The New Yorker, the migrant workers who follow climate disasters in the last 24 hours and then are exploited and die? Did you see this piece, Ali?
I haven't seen that piece yet, but I can only imagine.
Yeah. Let's talk about it next.
We'd love to.
The business community is dependent upon them. The big business community that is usually tied to Republicans is dependent upon them. We are dependent upon them so that we can afford the everyday necessities of life, including food. I mean, the inability of politicians of goodwill to speak to this issue in a way that is convincing, and even if your only motivation is selfish rather than selfless, and you've marketed it beautifully, Al, you're actually one of the best spokespeople without a close second on this issue, is so obvious to me, it is painful. So I hope that at least something gets done there.
Well, I got to say, I mean, I really want to thank the two of you for ensuring that this issue remains in the bloodstream, because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, immigration is by and large only seen as a concern in a negative way among conservative Americans and the immigrant community. But there's such a broad swath of liberal or progressive Americans who see themselves as good people of good conscience who they were wound up about immigration when Trump was in office. But, you know, like I read over the weekend, now they're mad about everything else except immigration. And this is just one of those foundational issues that I think drives so many other debates in our society.
Well, thank you. Marjorie doesn't care about it. It's me who's guiding the conversation. I want you to know, but that's not true. Don't send emails.
I just think that we ain't seen nothing yet, because you mentioned the climate change, migration. It's just going to become more and more intense, and people can't eat, right? I mean, no border is going to keep anybody from cross, it seems to me.
In any case, Ali, as always, we really learn a lot from you. Thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ali. Ali Narani is the president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Thanks again to Ali Narani. Coming up, we're opening up the lines and asking you, did you know it's the 5th anniversary of pot being legalized in the state of Massachusetts? We're asking, how things going for you 5 years later? Getting high with the kids? With the kids getting high on the back porch? Smelling marijuana everywhere? What is happening in your life 5 years after legalization of marijuana? You listen to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A reminder, our first day back in a long time at the Boston Public Library studio tomorrow, and we could not be more thrilled. Hope to see you. Even if I don't know what the capacity is these days, but at least look out the window and make some sign to us that is not obscene, if you don't mind. So 5 years ago, I think today 5 years ago, but 5 years ago, voters in Massachusetts approved recreational marijuana, creating an entirely new industry in the state. Dan Adams says 18,000 people are working in the industry. That's huge. We want to check in with you. Is marijuana making its way to your family gatherings in a more casual way? Have your attitudes changed? And you opponents, people who voted no, are you disappointed that none of the horror stories that you said were going to happen have actually happened? 877-301-8970. What does Adams write? $2.2 billion in revenue. By the way, usage by kids. Remember how that was going to explode? How horrible it was going to be? By the way, we don't mean kids. We mean not
teenagers.
Minors. You know, has not gone up dramatically. Driving while under the influence of marijuana, that's not happening.
gateway drug stuff. None of the horrors have happened. It's a new industry that is doing well by the state. Now, you have said repeatedly, even though it's legalized, and obviously you voted for it, and I voted for it too, and you have a history of occasionally when you're, you know, using the drug. Do you do it in front of your kids? Because a couple of years ago, once it was legal, you said you wouldn't do it, even though it was legal.
Well, luckily, my kids don't listen to me on the radio, so I
you still feel
funny
weird about
because
it
because I'm a mother.
But you drink in front of the kids.
Yes.
And they're both legal, and
yeah,
they're essentially the.
Well, you know, I tell you what, you feel. It's one of the gentlemen that's quit this. Pot shop owner that's quoted in the story says there's still a stigma around marijuana, and it's true. You know, you think about, I mean, have I indulged in marijuana since it became legal? Absolutely.
No, I didn't ask that. In front
I think
of your
one
kids.
Of the things that's great now is people can get these edibles, so that people who worry about smoking things don't have to worry about smoking things. And there's all these machines that you can use that cut down on the damage from the smoke and all that kind of stuff. But there is still a stigma around marijuana. You sort of feel as though. I do, anyway. Did you get high with your children, Jim?
I've had edibles with my younger kid, I think. Yeah, I have. 877.
Did you have a wild time?
It was pretty wild. No. 877-301-8970.
Did she think less of her father?
Do you think, by the way, you would be wonderful. We were talking about political division in this country. Wouldn't you like some honorable person, maybe in the next 10 minutes, to call and say, I was one of the people who voted no because I believed every horrible
health
thing was going to happen, and not one of them happened, and I learned a lesson from it. Wouldn't you like to get one call to that effect?
Well, I think that's the thing. I think we've learned, and a lot of us knew, that marijuana is like alcohol.
No, it's not. I think it's a lot safer than alcohol.
Let me finish this. Not in the sense of driving, because I think marijuana, not that you should be driving high, but you're better
of
off if they have a choice between the two. But it's a fun thing that you don't want, that you want to learn how to do in a moderate way. I mean, it's not like a drug like cocaine or heroin or the legally prescribed opioids that people get from their doctor's office and they wind up hooking opiates. It's a much more benign drug. And I think that was the thing that a lot of people knew that had started smoking as I did, you know, when I was a kid. And it's more benign. And it's nice that you can get these alternatives to smoking. So anyway, what do people think about this? I certainly have noticed the smell of marijuana everywhere. I was telling you, I like to walk around the Boston College Reservoir because it's really pretty up there. And they had a game the other night. You know, and you see the kids are walking toward the high school, and not just kids, like middle-aged people and older people with the six packs of beer, and they were going up there to do some tailgating, whenever they had the beer, the bitterness, and the wafts of marijuana smoke were like everywhere. It was pretty funny, and no one worries about it anymore because I don't think the cops are going to come arrest you for walking down around the Boston College Reservoir getting high. But I still think there's a feeling, you know, if you live as I do it with kids underneath me or something like that, I would feel funny about that.
You have little kids underneath you,
right? I think the oldest is 10 and 7, something like that.
877.
You know, the neighbor setting a bad example upstairs.
877-301-8970. Robert and Stoughton, you're going to lead us off. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say it's the best vote I think we as a country ever made because the reason is like the lady trying to compare alcohol to that, and that's totally out of bounds because it's just like you don't have to go on the street and buy something and feeling the anxiety waiting on a corner for a friend tell you I got a friend you worry anxiety you go somewhere you buy something that is even safer than alcohol. I just think that was a no brainer and it should have happened a long time ago.
Robert, beautifully. No, you nailed it. And thank you for the call. And by the way, Marjorie and I asked on all three marijuana ballot questions. The first was decriminalization. Second was medical. And then third was recreational. How many public officials? We asked every public official that ever came in our studio the years of those ballot campaigns, whether they were supporting legalization. Was Andrea Cabral the only elected official? I don't know if she was still sheriff or.
Politicians were absolutely disgraceful about this.
And bought into all the unproven myths.
Years ago, this is why I always liked Joe Malone. You know, Joe Malone.
Oh, this is one of the best columns.
This had to be 20 years ago when I was working at the Herald.
Before he became a Trumpian.
Before he became a Trumpian, that's right. Asking politicians about their marijuana experience.
He was treasurer then.
He was I asked Congressman Joe Kennedy, the father.
Elder, the father. Yeah.
I think I asked Evelyn Murphy, who was then with, she was lieutenant governor. I asked all these politicians. And the only one who really gave me a truthful answer was Joe Malone, which is why I really liked him. He said, I went to Harvard, went to some parties, smoked some pot. Everybody did that. You know, it was a big deal. And that was kind of true because he would have been at Harvard, I guess, in the late 70s, early 80s, something like that. And he told the truth. And I always thought that was great that he told the truth. Politicians were really ridiculous about this. And it's the same thing. It's because the guy says there's a stigma about it. We have been hysterical about drugs without differentiating between the dangerous drugs and the non-dangerous drugs. Lisa in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jer and Roger. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you.
I was just calling because I'm one of those people that Jim just referenced that actually voted against it 5 years ago and am willing to admit that I was wrong.
Whoa, Lisa.
You're going to get a gold star, Lisa.
Lisa.
So tell us what happened.
Yeah. What was the major thing that was said against it that convinced you to vote no?
Well, at the time, my oldest child is now almost 20, but at the time, he was pretty much a brand new driver, had just gotten his license, and I was simply worried that people would be smoking and driving, and he would be a brand new driver on the road with people who were impaired, and it made me nervous. I really thought it would be a bigger problem than it actually turned out to be, so...
Oh, I love you.
I can definitely admit that I was wrong.
Good for you. In all seriousness, good for you. Lisa, thank you very much for the call. Do you think all the politicians who voted no on this, some of whom are still in office benefiting from the tax revenue, would admit that they were wrong?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think we've done that story. Maybe somebody should do the story.
Think the former mayor of Fall River would admit that he was wrong?
Well, the former mayor of Fall River, of course, is going to jail. Part of his problem was extorting all this money from trying to extort all this money
what
from
you trying?
This local.
He was convicted.
He was convicted.
Trying.
That's right. Yeah, he did do it. And that is one of the problems, that there has been a lot of extortion, not the illegal kind of extortion.
These community host
but these
agreements.
Borderline,
yeah.
You know, let's get as much money as we possibly can out of these pot shop owners to, you know, fix the rotary, whatever it is. That's really
Did you see
unfair.
That North Adams and one other community have dropped those the fees for those community host deals because of the not only – I mean, there are two problems with it. One, corruption in some cases. Two, it really screwed – the whole goal was equity here. Mm-hmm. That was drafted into the statute that was approved by the voters by the great Shailene Title, who was a commissioner on the Cannabis Control Commission for a while. And one of the reasons they haven't met their equity goals is because of these exorbitant fees that a lot of startup companies with people of color and lower income people who this law is supposed to benefit can't afford.
Tim in the car, thank you for calling.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Thank you.
Listen, I'm 68 years old.
Stop. Can I ask you a question before you continue?
Sure.
Why does everybody who's over 60 years old who calls our show feel they have to tell us how old they are in the first sentence?
That's
Could you
okay.
explain?
No,
I'm not criticizing him. I'm
right.
asking him. Why? Why?
Well, because we're talking about pot, and
now.
I used to smoke pot when I was in college, and until I got married, and then I didn't smoke pot at all until it became legal. And now I smoke it.
Well, that's a good answer. That's a good answer. Go ahead.
We were at a party with
Marjorie.
A bunch of people my age and older, and they were going around with a little basket full of gummies, saying, "Would you like a gummy?" And I'm going like, "Whoa, this is totally different."
Yeah, you know, I was at
Tim,
a party
that was
like that too, or after.
Recently?
Yeah, it was about 2 years ago before the vapes got all the bad press. I think they've been vindicated somewhat now. But somebody went around at the coffee at dessert time and said, "You know, I got a vape pen. Anybody want to step out in the back porch?" And I thought, oh, my God, the revolution is here. You know, it was like wild, Tim. So did people enjoy themselves with the little gummies?
We know Tim did.
Absolutely. You know, and it was no different than offering a Jell-O shot or something like that. And it was peaceful. It was nice. Everybody was happy. And we're talking about people who were 70 years old.
Yeah.
Tim, you're great. That was great.
It is just back into it's back in, and everybody is doing it.
How much do you love the joy in Tim's voice? Tim, thank you very much for the call. That was great.
There was a great story about maybe 10 years ago now in the New York Times. It was talking about people that started smoking pot, like Tim said, when they were in college, and they went on to become responsible husbands and wives and taxpayers, and they had all these jobs. And in other words, they didn't become stoners hanging around the side.
Didn't Jerry Rubin become a Wall Street stockbroker?
Yeah, he did.
He
yeah,
did. He did. John is.
But the point was that everybody didn't, as people are emailing that have had people, somebody just emailed that has someone that wound up going from marijuana to hard drugs. But in any case, that they functioned like fine members of society.
Didn't Baker admit to us that he smoked when he was at Harvard?
I'm not sure. The only one I know about is Joe Malone. John just emailed and said, the first guest or caller to BPR admitted that they were wrong. Now, if only Jim.
I've admitted I was wrong about a lot. I was virtually every political prediction I've ever made is wrong. I acknowledge that in a second. 877-301-8970 is our phone number. Let's go to Dee in Andover. Dee, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling in. Hi, Dee.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Hi. Big fan of the show. Thank I'm not you. Using my full name.
Oh.
But I want I want you to know that this is the best decision Massachusetts ever made. It's completely changed my life. I have
apparently.
No anxiety. I sleep at night, and I bring edibles to tennis matches, and I'm spreading the love. Like, all these middle-aged ladies now are all addicted to edibles, thanks to me.
Dee, that was a beautiful way to end the show, I'll tell
you.
That was lovely.
You do hear that a lot, that a lot of women
tennis players
post 40 years old have sleeping problems, and the edibles, the down edibles, right, Dee, can have a considerable impact in a good way on your sleeping. Dee, thank you very much for the call. I think we have to expand this conversation so we have more time, Jim, to discuss really what's going on with marijuana use in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Well, I assume we'll have Dan Adams in again soon, who's done great work. The Globe has done great covering this whole marijuana thing from day one.
Yeah, he has a newsletter.
Really done well. I know he does. Yeah.
What is it called?
I don't know.
Weed Matters or News and Weed?
No, I think your newsletter is Weed Matters.
This Week in Weed.
Thank you very much.
Isn't that a great title, This Week
yes.
in Weed? Anyway, we are done. Thank you very much for tuning in. Tomorrow we're going to be back at the Boston Public Library for our grand return. We're thrilled about that. We're going to be joined by Sports Authority Trenton Kuznarek, Lydia Downey of Pine Street Inn.
Oh,
I can't wait
I'm
to
so
talk
glad.
To her because she's
too.
Been taking a lot of unfair hits, I think, lately about Mass and Cast. And our transportation czars, Jim Aloisi and Stacey Thompson. I want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, and Rebecca Tauber. Our engineer, John the Claw Parker. What's on television, Jim?
What's on television? What's the question? Could you repeat the question,
please?
You
have a television show.
I do have
you're
a
You're going to be taping in just
television.
A couple of hours. Do you know what you're doing, or are you just going to freeze?
I do not.
Oh, you don't?
Well, I do, man, I do, but I can't remember at this particular moment. So I know what it was. The Pandora Papers, which we're also, we're going to have those guys on again tomorrow, too. The Frontline thing on this this dump of 12 million documents to a bunch of news organizations that basically demonstrate world leaders, heads of governments are depositing their money to secret it away in lots of places. You know, one of the most desired locations where you can do anything secret, dump your money? It's not the Bahamas. It's not the Caymans. You know where it is?
Where?
South Dakota.
South
We're going to talk about that tonight. I am Jim Browdy. We really hope you see you at the library tomorrow.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. We will be at the Boston Public Library. I hope you have a great day.